So good morning, everyone. I am going to call this meeting of the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency's Advisory Planning Commission to order. Today is Wednesday, December 8th, 2021. It's right at 9:30. Thank you for joining us. The first item on the agenda is to call the roll to determine our quorum. So Tracy, could you please help me with that?
Mr. Oling? Mr. Booth?
Good morning, present.
Ms. Carr?
Good morning, I'm here, thank you.
Ms. Chandler?
Good morning, present.
Mr. Drake? Mr. Drew?
We didn't hear you, sorry, but I see you there. There you go.
Present.
I'm going to try that one again. Mr. Drew, I see you there.
Yeah, good morning.
Mr. Ferry?
Present.
Ms. Ferris?
Good morning.
Mr. Gavan? Mr. Hill?
Good morning.
Ms. Jacobson?
Good morning.
Mr. Hitchcock?
Good morning.
Ms. Simon?
Morning, here.
Mr. Teixeira?
Present and accounted for.
Mr. Smoggy? And Mr. Young?
Here.
Ms. Sala, I thought you were not joining us, but I see you on here today too. Ms. Stella, it looks like you're self-muted. Perhaps she's not paying attention. We'll come back to that. We do have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Tracy. Good morning again, everyone. I will now go over the meeting rules for the day. Please bear with me. To observe the meeting, go to trpa.gov. Under the calendar header, click on Advisory Planning Commission online meeting for December 8, 2021. There you'll find a link to the public webinar hosted on GoToWebinar. To address APC members directly with your comments, please utilize the hand-raising function in the control panel of GoToWebinar, which you should see under the red microphone. At the appropriate time for public comments, please raise your hand by clicking on the hand icon, and a TRPA staff member will unmute you to indicate you can begin your public comments. Please state your name. If you've requested a reasonable accommodation from TRPA and have been provided a unique PIN number, you'll be unmuted at the time you requested to make your public comments. If you're using the Instant Join web app, please make sure it's opened. Let's see. Finally, if you called into the general attendee line with the access code, please be aware this is a listen-only option. To APC members, if you wish to speak, you can alert me via the chat function. This must not be used for sidebar conversations. Please, everyone, excuse me, I'm having a moment here. Remember to mute your microphone unless you're speaking to cut down on background noise. And please turn on your cameras, as we do have sufficient capacity to accommodate all members. Moving on to the approval of the agenda. Staff, do we have any changes to the agenda?
Mr. Chairman, there are no changes to the agenda.
Thank you, John. We will go ahead and deem the agenda approved as posted. Now I will move on to public interest comments, which is item 3 on the agenda. If any member of the public wishes to address the APC, please use the hand-raising function now and you'll be unmuted by a TRPA staff member. Please keep your comments brief and concise. I have the discretion to set time limits. Let's see. Any unheard comments submitted via email will be forwarded to all APC members, and we did get one comment Please note the APC is prohibited by law from taking immediate action on or discussing issues by the public that are not on the agenda. So I will now turn this over to Catherine to see if we have any public that would like to make a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a public comment.
Thank you, Catherine. We're now on to item 4, which is disposition of minutes. We do have a set of minutes from November 10th, 2021. It's on page 1 of your packet. Thank you, Tracy, for preparing those. Are there any questions or comments from APC members on the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Steve, please go ahead.
Thank you, sir. So I'm on page 15, a top paragraph. And just want a clarification, and maybe Mr. Gabon can help me with the proper terminology here. But this says, in regard to the Caldor fire, Mr. Gabon advised there is going to be an after action coordinated by Lake Valley Fire Protection District, as they were the, and it says the agency. And the question that I have is that were they the lead local agency or the lead something? Eric, what would be the proper terminology there?
The lead local agency would be probably the most appropriate. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Eric. So my comment on the minutes would be to insert the words lead local in front of agency at the top of page 15. Thank you.
Good comment, Steve. Thanks. Any other comments, questions on the minutes? Okay.
If there are no others, I make a motion to approve the minutes with the one addition that I suggested.
Thank you, Steve.
I'll second the motion. This is Jennifer.
Thanks, Jennifer. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any objections? Any abstentions?
Yes, this is Heather Ferris. I was not here, so I'm going to abstain from voting.
Thanks, Heather.
Sam Booth, I'll also abstain.
Thank you, Sam. Okay, excellent. Thank you. Thank you again, Tracy, for preparing those. I'm going to move us on to agenda item 5, which is administrative matters. Item 5A is the election of a chair and a vice chair for the APC. As you know, we've gone through our 2-year cycle here, and so it's time now, again, to look at the chair and vice chair of the committee. Information on this item can be found on page 17 of your packet. And I guess I'm going to ask if anyone has any suggestions for a nomination for an advisory planning commission chair for the years 2022 and 2023.
This is Susan. I'd like to nominate Brandon Ferry to be the chair for the next 2 years of the APC.
Second.
All right. Thanks, Susan and Steve. Any other comments on that? All right. Great. That sounds excellent. I'm going to move us to the vice chair. Would anyone like to make a nomination for vice chair for the calendar years 2022-2023?
I make a motion to elect Jennifer Carr as the vice chair.
Second.
Steve and Jason, thank you very much. Any further discussion on the vice chair?
Are we voting on both these motions at one time?
I believe we will, yes.
Okay.
Any further discussion, APC members? Okay. I'm going to go ahead and take public comment on this item. If any member of the public wishes to address the Advisory Planning Commission on this item, please raise your hand in the GoToWebinar and you'll be unmuted by a TRPA staff member. Catherine, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a comment on this item.
Okay. Any further discussion?
I would just say, Mr. Chair, that you have done and Jennifer has done an outstanding job leading us for the last couple of years, and that's why I support you going forward for another two-year term each.
Thank you, Steve. I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Steve. That's very kind.
Yeah. I hope we can get back in person and see each other soon. This has been an interesting 2 years. I'm still not used to presenting on GoToWebinar, obviously.
Mr. Chairman, I would just add that, you know, appreciation to you and Jennifer for being willing to do it. We all have lots on our plates, so the fact that you guys are adding this in is appreciated by all of us. Everybody's busy, and it takes a lot of time and effort, and it's appreciated.
Thanks, Jason. Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Although I will add, for anyone thinking about it, maybe for 2 years from now, the TRPA staff make it really easy. So it's not something to be afraid of. So, but I'm happy to do it for another couple of years because they make it so easy.
That's right. Okay. Is it possible to put the motion up on the screen? Otherwise, it's a pretty straightforward. There we go. Would anyone care to make the motion?
I'll make the motion if we're doing both together.
Looks like we are. Yep.
So I'll say for the record, motion to approve Brendan Ferry as the Planning Commission Chair and Jennifer Carr as the Vice Chair effective January 1st, 2022 for another 2 year term.
Second.
Who was the first second there? Jason. Thank you. Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Tracy, I'll turn it over to you for a roll call vote, please.
Thank you. Mr. Oling? Ms. Chandler?
Approve.
Mr. Booth?
Aye.
Mr. Drake?
Approve.
Ms. Carr?
Yes.
Mr. Drew?
Yes.
Mr. Gavon?
Yes.
Ms. Jacobson?
Yes.
Ms. Ferris?
Yes.
Mr. Hitchcock?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Simon?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Smokey? Mr. Young?
Yes.
Ms. Stella? Mr. Ferry?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, that motion passes.
Thank you, Tracy. I'm going to pass this over to John Hester for a moment to speak on behalf of TRPA staff.
Well, Mr. Chair, we appreciate all the effort you've both put in and look forward to working with you. And as you'll see when I introduce item A1 as an introduction to A2, we have some plans in place to work with you to involve the APC more as you and the members decide you'd like to be involved. So with that, I'm ready to go ahead and start with agenda item A1. And congratulations. So for the record, I'm John Hester, Chief Operating Officer and Deputy Executive Director. It's my privilege to introduce the Climate Change and Sustainability Initiative, which is the one that most transcends or extends throughout our entire work plan, and also briefly cover the other initiatives and the overall work program. So you get a broader view of how climate change and sustainability transcends our work and provides some context, especially for the newer APC members. I want to recognize our staff, like you all, who have worked during the pandemic, the fire and the evacuation. As you know, we had to evacuate our building, as many of you had to evacuate your homes and places of work. And we've also had record levels of service on applications and inspections. So we are, like Member Drew said, doing our best to struggle through these difficult times, and we appreciate the partnership we have with you. So if I could go to the next slide. The one after that, sorry. That was my intro slide. The topics I want to cover briefly are on this slide. I want to set the stage really today for Devin to take a much deeper dive into the climate change and sustainability initiative. But I do, like I said, want to make sure that you all have an overview of all the strategic initiatives. Next slide. So my first part of this is to tell you a little bit about an overview of how we're focusing on climate change in our operations work plan. If you look at this chart across the bottom, you see the components of most contemporary climate change and sustainability initiatives. Mitigation is on the left, greenhouse gas reduction. That was the focus of our 2014 Regional Sustainability Action Plan. That plan, as you may recall, won a National Planning Award, TRPA's first. And we're very proud of that, but we've moved beyond that. Devin will tell you how much of that's been implemented, and we're very proud of that too. But now we also need to look at adaptation and the result we hope for, which is resiliency. And adaptation, what we're really talking about is what kind of changes do we need to make to existing systems like infrastructure, forest management, and things like that, so that we are able to better handle flooding, droughts, the extremes that climate change is bringing us. But resiliency is the outcome we hope for, and it's really the ability to prepare for and recover from climate change-driven disruptions, including less obvious things besides floods and fires like recreation, tourism, and economy impacts. In the middle of this chart, you'll see the tools that the compact gives TRPA to address climate change. So as you know, the thresholds are our standards and our goals really for what we want to achieve. The regional plan and code and implementing, that is all implemented with projects through both public and private investment. And the top is really how we implement. We already do some things we call climate smart management and use current tools like our plug-in electric vehicle plan, the grants we've received. I think some of you may recall, and Devin will cover this, I believe, that we teamed with the Truckee Donner PUD to develop a plug-in electric vehicle plan covering the corridor, the area from I-80 corridor to the US 50 corridor. And that was set the stage for us to seek funding for PEV chargers, for example. That's an example of what we can do. You're using the current tools. We also want to refine those standards. We want to work on the thresholds and plans to reflect the climate focus I talked about on adaptation and resiliency. And also, Devin will talk about carbon sequestration. Then we want to implement new standards and plans with changes in our ordinances and revised projects. And those will show up both in our code and in our environmental improvement program. Next slide. So the role, moving a little more, being a little more general, the role of our work plan, as you know, is, but to refresh you, is our governing board sets strategic objectives or pillars every few years in the strategic plan update. Those have remained the four that are listed there: accelerate threshold attainment, be a leader in sustainability, which this climate change and sustainability initiative directly reflects, use best science, and operate as a high performance team. And that gives us the strategic initiatives, the six that are listed below, that I will talk about a little bit more in a second. And that results in this work plan and the annual budget. Now, given the disruptions we've had this year, we're actually in the middle of this, or close to the middle of this operations work plan year, and the budget's already been approved, but we wanted to go ahead and give you an update on that. Next slide. So this shows you the relationship between the strategic objectives and the initiatives. And so climate change and sustainability, I will leave pretty much to Devin to go into more detail. On transportation and sustainable recreation, what we're doing there is addressing transportation funding and implementation, plus the impact on recreation and tourism and the impact of recreation and tourism travel on the region. It's not something that we control through land use and those things as much as an impact we feel from the growth around our region and the changes in the climate. And we also are addressing greenhouse gas reduction from a transportation perspective. That's the biggest part of the greenhouse gas emissions inventory that we can directly impact. And Devin will go into that a little bit. Our housing and community revitalization effort, as you know, you all are leading the working group on that, continuing to work on near, medium, and long-term priorities. And I think we reported last month that the ADU and some of the other code amendments that you all recommended got approved. And it also will address climate change and sustainability by trying to provide more housing in the basin for those who work in the basin so that we can reduce commute trips and reduce greenhouse gas. Environmental improvement program implementation, what we are working on there, and some of you I know are involved in the TAI steering committee and the EIP committee. The update to the EIP will focus on responses to climate change and sustainability. Moving to thresholds and monitoring, what we really are trying to do there is look at the thresholds through the lens of climate considerations so that the standards in the EIP will have either the threshold standards or the EIP performance standards will reflect that. For example, our first new threshold that you all know we worked very hard on for a couple of years is greenhouse gas reduction from the new greenhouse gas per capita threshold standard. Our digital first innovation initiative is about obtaining information, allowing people to obtain information or get services online. It allows people to use our services and our information 24/7. We are in the middle of that. We are looking at a permitting software update and other things like that. So that's what that will be about. That also obviously will reduce GHG emissions if people can interact with us remotely and staff can be remote. We'll continue to bring updates on all the other initiatives to you throughout the year. But I want to kind of pause here and point out for those who are relatively new, the previous chair, Steve Teixeira, and Bob Larson, when he was vice chair, worked very hard on a charter that we took to the governing board about the role of APC in supporting TRPA's initiatives. And you may recall, some of you, that the APC played a key role in updating the residential allocations process. Bob was chair of the threshold update steering, threshold update working group. I think it was called TUI-SWIG, but I don't remember what all the initials stood for, but one of our most unique acronyms. But anyway, that group led the threshold standards update framework, created a framework for how we update thresholds and what they need to include. You are also, as I mentioned already, leading the initiative and the work on housing and community revitalization through the TAO Living Working Group. So you have already played and are playing a key role in supporting these initiatives, but I know there's a desire from some of you and from the chair and vice chair to make the APC's role in each initiative or those that are relevant more beneficial both to the region and to the organizations you represent. So I know they'll be reaching out to you. So with that kind of as an overview and an introduction, I would like to thank you for listening to me, answer any questions, and if not, turn it over to Devin to go into more detail about the climate change and sustainability initiative.
Thanks, John. Anyone have any questions for John?
Mr. Chair, I do.
Devin, go ahead.
Thanks for the presentation, John. I'm just curious why the strategic objective operate as a high-performing team only applies to two of the six strategic initiatives.
Sorry, I had to unmute myself. I think it could apply to all of them, but what we're really focusing on there is process improvement more than anything else. So it's the ones that are most on point. As you probably know, in housing and community revitalization, Karen Fink, one of our program managers, is now serving as a housing program ombudsperson, trying to figure out ways to improve the processes that TRPA is responsible for housing and community revitalization efforts. For example, she was involved in the Sugar Pine project, even though she wasn't the person writing the permit. And she's also involved in the Mountain Housing Council and Tahoe Prosperity Center. So that one, and obviously the innovation initiative where we try to convert, change processes and go digital with more things, those are obvious. You're right, we should always be trying to be more high performance in every one of these, Kevin. So appreciate the comment.
Thanks, Kevin.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for John.
Yeah, go ahead, Jason.
John, and Devin may want to speak to this as well. I know one of the things that's been discussed over the last several years is, you know, you have EIP implementation as separate here. We've talked about the thresholds, especially water quality and soils SEZ, as their own topics for a long time, but you know, transportation, sustainable recreation, the climate change and sustainability, even housing to some extent, really start to interface with some of what we think of as more traditional thresholds. What kinds of discussions have you guys had internally about how we start to better integrate what I would talk about as the traditional thresholds and some of the new initiatives and focuses in terms of climate change and sustainable recreation?
Well, I'll take a first shot at it and then let Devin take it. But at some point, I think we will ask Dan Segan to come give you an update on what he's doing on the thresholds. But I think our perspective as we look at them has changed from just in the threshold update steering working group, threshold update initiative steering working group identified this for us as, we need to be looking at thresholds not as just a number, but as something where we say, what exactly is the underlying system that we are trying to intervene into, and how does that work? If what's the outcome we expect if we, say, for example, if we sequester some more carbon, what's the outcome we expect and for the money we invest to do that? And then how does that show up not only in the threshold, but in the regional plan policies, in the code, in EIP priorities. And so they've kind of given us that framework. And, you know, honestly, and I think this is kind of where you're going, Jason, is the distinction between these different categories is sort of arbitrary. And we try not to silo things. It's all interrelated. And I think all of us who think about this at all these days realize that what we really have is one big system where all these pieces interact. So that's, I think, what the new threshold framework that came out of the working group is trying to get us to recognize is it's not, you can do things in isolation. They have to all work together. And I know you've asked about infrastructure, and I think our climate adaptation part of our initiative, Devin can talk about more, we'll start addressing infrastructure more than we have in the past relative to climate change. Hope that answers your question a little bit, and I'll turn it over to Devin.
Yeah, I can add on to that. And I do have a slide in my presentation coming up on specifically on the EIP as another thread that's going on right now. The Tahoe Interagency Executive Steering Committee, which is the governing body for the EIP, this month had part one of their strategic planning retreat, and they're going to have part two in February. And we presented a proposal to connect the climate initiatives, climate change through threshold update, all wrapped under the EIP program as that overarching framework for how we're doing it. So we are very much integrating EIP across climate and all of those other program areas.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate that. It's good to hear. I know many on this call are aware. Part of the reason I asked this question is also because in the past, funding has been siloed. It's been very focused on one initiative or one threshold or one resource area. And I know many of us on this call have worked really hard over the last decade to try and work with the federal and state partners on being more creative about how those funding can be allocated to programs. Because if you have integrated programs, but you don't have integrated funding, it makes it really difficult to implement projects because you've got to piece together, you know, multiple different funding sources, and they all have caveats about what they can and can't be used for. So I don't know, John or Devin, maybe are we making progress on achieving, you know, creativity with the funding sources?
Yeah, I think we are seeing new federal and state funding sources coming down that have that multi-benefit, more flexibility. For example, the California just announced the REAP 2.0, the Regional Early Access Planning Grants. And we actually, as the Metropolitan Planning Organization for the region, are getting a direct allocation through that program. And that the funding guidelines are probably some of the most flexible I've seen out of the state in terms of funding planning and implementation, having the multiple benefits, this program specifically around housing and transportation. So we are seeing that. And then with the new infrastructure bill coming down, there's a lot of funding opportunities in electric vehicles and just infrastructure in general, bridges that we should be positioned well as a region to compete for. So we are seeing sort of that top-down flexibility coming from the federal and the state and, you know, through our activities of working with the agencies that send that funding and leaving comments on grant guidelines, we always leave comments to that effect.
Jason, just to add on to that, as part of the TIE retreat, a funding strategy is part of one of the deliverables that we'll be looking at as these thresholds are all updated, repackaged, climate integrated, et cetera. You know, we need to tie thresholds to the EIP performance measures, line up the projects below that in the tracker, and then have a funding strategy that ties in through all that piece, and then have a dashboard that folks can, you know, gain information quickly on and be able to report out on. So I think that TRPA staff is, and all the partners, are really trying to tie all those pieces together. But it's really good comment you have. Let's see. I have a couple other requests here for questions, comments. So I'm going to go to Eric Young.
Thank you. Good morning. I really appreciate this discussion about the systems approach and systems context, John, and the sort of the anti-silo work that's being done. It's been one of my growing concerns lately. I think it's, even when you know it and when you're really aware of it, it's still something that takes constant concerted effort to work against, because there's just a natural kind of a flow towards a silo effect. I was really impressed and thankful for the movement towards the working groups that have been established that include the APC members. I think that's been incredibly valuable and really moved the ball forward. Every one of those working groups has moved the ball forward on what they were asked to do. It's been a great concept, but even just built within that working group concept is a little bit of a silo effect, with each of them working on their own projects. And there has to be, I know it's hard. I'm not saying you're not doing it. Not at all, but it has to be an ongoing, just daily recognition that we don't want to step on each other's feet. We don't want to move forward a regulation or a concept or a rule that is going to trip up the regulation concept or rule that another working group has been, you know, working on for a few months. That kind of understanding of what each other is doing and how it may impact the work of each different working group is something that's difficult, but I think that we have to make sure that somehow we find a way to do that. And John, if there's anybody that can do that, I know it's you. I just wanted to mention that I'm on the housing group, and I really appreciate it. But over the last few months, I feel like a lot of the comments that some of the other working group members have been making are really kind of about how difficult some of the other things in CRPA are making it for them to do the to build the housing. And so just a little bit of cross-referencing or cross-work on these working groups, I don't know how to do it, so I apologize for throwing it out there without a better idea. But going forward, I think the anti-silo work is something that just, it's not something you can just do once. It has to be constantly thought of. So thank you for listening. I appreciate it.
I appreciate your comment, Eric, and couldn't agree more. And it's something that I know Joanne Marchetta, the executive director, and I and others have talked about. It has to be a way of doing business every day. And we're trying to evolve into that. So totally agree with you. I think your comments are right on point. Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Gavon has a comment. Are you there, Eric? You're on mute.
Now? Okay, there we go. Sorry, guys. Yeah, I just wanted to echo a lot of those comments. I appreciate the fact that TRPA is looking at more of a funnel and a shift sifting mechanism to set priorities on these goals. And instead of a silo, using those analogies, I guess, I think, you know, going to more of a business model is really important. Seeing that in even the fire service and how that pertains to prevention around the lake. We really have to look at what's common sense and not just no, because we said so kind of thing. We got to do the science and the common sense. So I appreciate that. I look at this and I think, John, you and I had a conversation, I don't know, maybe it was 3 years ago, about going electronic with the plans and how important that would be for TRPA to be there. And, you know, we talked about it'd be a ways off, but of course, with COVID, it made it a millennium jump. So I think that's huge. And I really appreciate TRPA looking at that and the flexibility that you guys have had. You know, it takes a lot to turn a ship, and you guys have been doing a great job. But I think that initiative alone will save a lot of travel miles to the basin, getting those electronic plans, working remotely. Those are huge leaps, and I know they make a difference in the environment and the product of work that's being turned out. So I certainly appreciate that, John. Thank you very much for your comments.
Thank you, Eric, and I hope we can get together sooner than another 3 years and look forward to continuing to work together on these kind of things.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Eric. Any other comments? Just quickly, Devin, before I go to you, I do just want to, you know, reiterate the obvious that for APC members, at least, it's obvious that I did send out an email last week mentioning that we do want to engage a little further and deeper on some of these topics now that we've seen TRPA's work plan. And so Jennifer and I have kind of broken up the group, and you'll be hearing from either her or I maybe later this week to see if we can set up a time so that we could talk individually with you. Or what I was thinking is perhaps we could talk with the agency representative and their layperson perhaps at the same time, if we can make that work. So, you know, for instance, Kevin and Crystal could meet together for Placer County, if that works, so we can get that kind of shared perspective from the jurisdiction and cut down on meetings, since there's quite a few of us. But we are really interested in engaging with all of you. To see, you know, check the pulse and check in with everyone and see how things are going, see what this work plan means to you, what your priorities are, what we as APC can do to further this work plan along and assist the basin towards its goals. So I just wanted to mention that we'll be reaching out. So with that,
and I'll Brennan, build up. Can I add to that just real quick?
Yeah, Jennifer, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no problem. So one of the things that I'd be interested in, too, is hearing from the members as we talk to you about, like, where you feel your strengths lie in some of these areas. You know, my strengths are in, you know, engineering and science. So it's more EIP and thresholds and monitoring.
you know, I do my best to keep pace with housing and community revitalization, but it's not my strength. So thankfully there are others that have that strength. So, you know, having some idea where everyone's strengths lie might help us and help TRPA, you know, manage some of these topics going forward.
Yep, that's a great point.
Mr. Chair, may I?
Yes, please.
Maybe a suggestion I have for you and the co-chair is maybe a survey. Just send a survey out. We'd be happy to take a few minutes and answer that. That'll save you some running around. So if you can get a survey out, you know, asking people what their strengths are or whatever, get them back to you guys, and then you can maybe prioritize those visits a little bit.
Yeah, thanks. We did talk about that as an option, Eric. So yeah, I'll get together with Jennifer and we'll finalize our thoughts on that and be in touch. Okay. Thank you all for this discussion. Devin, you're ready. I'm going to turn this over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Devin Middlebrook, Sustainability Program Manager here at TRPA for the record. Next slide, Tracy. We all don't need to be reminded of the impacts of climate change that are being seen on the Tahoe Basin today. We all lived through, even on those on the North Shore, lived through the smoke of the wildfire season this last year. And hopefully this upcoming weekend finally breaks the snow drought that we've been having outside, which has been disappointing for the ski season so far. But these impacts, you know, when we talk about climate, typically when we talk about it, it's impacts that are coming in 2100, in the next 50 years, the next 100 years. But we've seen in the last couple of years that those impacts are happening today, and we need to be able to address those. Next slide. Climate is not only having impacts on the basin directly, it is also interacting with historic threats such as forest overgrowth, increased visitation on the basin. And when we talk about addressing climate impacts, as Mr. Hester said earlier, we have those three buckets: mitigation, reducing our emissions, adaptation, adjusting our systems to anticipate those upcoming changes, and then the resilience of the system, the ability for us to withstand those shocks and get back to business after something like a fire evacuation. Next slide. I presented earlier this year to the APC about our greenhouse gas inventory, so I won't be too repetitive on this, but just as a reminder, we recently updated our greenhouse gas emission inventory for the basin, and you can see the trends from 2005 to 2018. Our emissions have gone down, which is good. John mentioned our 2014 Sustainability Action Plan that had identified 72 climate actions for the basin, mostly around mitigation and adaptation. And today, over 75% of those actions have been implemented or are actively being implemented. And you can see that that meant our emissions have gone down. However, more work is needed. Between 2015 and 2018, we did see a slight uptick in those emissions. Next slide. And this is all in an effort towards reaching not only the region's greenhouse gas reduction goals, which is net zero by 2045, and that is in line with both California and Nevada's goals. And then happy to say that yesterday, the city of South Lake Tahoe adopted a new resolution to go 100% renewable electricity, locally generated 24/7 by 2030. So they have we have a very ambitious greenhouse gas reduction goal on for the city of South Lake Tahoe. Next slide. We also, for the first time, looked at carbon sequestration, or the amount of carbon our landscape is absorbing. And this is really an emerging field of research. So you can see through that balance sheet that we created, our emissions going out from human caused sources and the sequestration in the forests and the meadows. There is uncertainty in there because it is modeled. But you can see that our net balance is anywhere from net positive emissions, or if we're emitting more than we're absorbing, to actually sequestering more than we emit every year. But as we saw with the Caldor fire, it doesn't take much for all of that carbon that's stored in our landscape to be released back into the atmosphere through wildfire. So forest fuels and forest management is very important. And it's also important to know that sequestration is not the magic bullet to our problems. We need to reduce our emissions while increasing our sequestration potential. Next slide. So that was mitigation. Now on adaptation, there's been a lot of work going on, you know, beating the the horse on the Caldor Fire example, you can see the map there where it shows the Caldor Fire path overlaid with all of the forest fuel treatment work that has gone on in the Tahoe Basin. And you can really see that that wildland urban interface in the South Shore was surrounded by those fuel reduction treatments. And that, along with the brave first responders and firefighters, were able to miraculously prevent any loss of structures in the Tahoe Basin. If anyone lives in Christmas Valley, it's amazing that that is still there. But you can see that that is an adaptation action when we start talking about things like that. That is what we're talking about in terms of climate adaptation. And there's a number of plans in place at the moment at a federal, state, and regional level to address adaptation. The Forest Service is working on adaptation plans specific to recreation. California just came out with their draft updated climate adaptation strategy. And this August, the Conservancy released a climate adaptation primer and adaptation portfolio for the region. Next slide. And then getting back to, I think, the thread that Mr. Hester was talking about in this this board picked up on is the interconnectedness and de-siloing that climate brings to the other programs in the region. As you can see, we still have those three buckets of mitigation, adaptation, and resiliency. But within each of those, they are very much interconnected within all of our other initiatives. You can see transportation crosses between mitigation and adaptation, and the EIP is really about resiliency. So you can see that all of those interconnected are woven together by the threat of climate change, and that's how we're framing all of our strategic initiatives in order to keep that consistency, break down those silos, and move implementation. Next slide. As mentioned in response to Mr. Drew's question, the Lake Tahoe Environmental Improvement Program, the catchphrase of the slogan for the EIP now is a blueprint for climate resilience. So this is that overarching framework that how we're thinking about climate and bringing more climate adaptation and resilience to the Tahoe Basin. You can see on the right of the slide, those five areas and those hexagons, those are the products that we're bringing forward over the next year through the TAI Steering Committee. An updated funding strategy for climate adaptation and resilience projects in the basin. The basin has had a lot of success with these action funding plans, such as the Forest Fuels Action Plan, which has brought millions of dollars to the basin. So using that success, building on that success, that's how we are going to be approaching the funding. Dan Segan on our team is going to be leading an update to the threshold standards and really making our thresholds climate smart. This is tied to those performance measures. So we're really thinking about that whole system approach where we're not just setting threshold standards like they did in the 80s that have no way of being measured and don't really connect to anything environmentally related. These are really narrowing in on those threshold standards that are most relevant to the problems we face today and in the future, and then using those performance measures to track progress towards that through project implementation. And then finally, being able to capture the broader climate resilience landscape and metrics through an updated resilience dashboard where we can capture things like electric vehicle adoption, renewable energy generation, and other aspects. So over the next year, these products are all going to be moving forward, and I'm sure at some point we'll come back to the APC with an update on those as they get developed. Next slide. Next is transportation. So I'm going to walk through some of our strategic initiatives and really talk how specific examples of how we're integrating climate with transportation. One of the biggest program areas is electrification of our vehicle infrastructure. In 2017, we developed with partners the Tahoe Truckee Plug-in Electric Vehicle Readiness Plan, and we went beyond just the Tahoe Basin boundaries. We actually went from the 80 corridor to the 50 corridor, so we included Truckee. So we're really looking at that bigger system here, not just within the basin. And that plan actually won two awards from the Nevada APA. And since the adoption in 2017, we've seen a 50% increase in the availability of charging stations in the Tahoe Basin. You can see the number of stations and locations. We also have more electric buses coming on board. The photo in the bottom left is of the new mobility hub at the Community College in South Shore, where there'll be overhead induction chargers installed for the Tahoe Transportation District's new electric buses, which is exciting. And Lake Tahoe Unified School District has, I believe, two or three electric school buses in their fleet now that are operating. So we've seen a lot of increase in this. And I think over the next year, we have identified a number of potential code updates and permit streamlining for electric vehicles that may be an opportunity for this APC to help shape in order to increase that adoption. Next slide. Within sustainable recreation and tourism, obviously climate is a big factor in how our tourism system and tourism demand is dictated. You can see during a winter like this where we have no snow, that's going to impact travel behavior, not only if people want to come to Tahoe or not come to Tahoe. There's a lot of people that are doing summer-based activities right now, going hiking, going down to the beach. So those changing patterns are something that we're interested in. The Tahoe Regional Planning Agency was also a founding signatory of the Future of Tourism Coalition, which is a group, an international coalition of destinations around the world that are trying to solve the sustainable recreation puzzle, which no one has quite done yet, but we're working on it. And then the Lake Tahoe region was also recognized as a top 100 global sustainable destination in 2019. Next slide. Within housing, I think housing has many aspects of climate mitigation and adaptation built into it. As we know, a lot of our local workforce has to commute from outside the region in for work. So by building more local housing, you're cutting down on those vehicle trips. And for example, the Sugar Pine Village is also building in energy efficiency and renewable energies into their project. So it's going to be a very sustainable development. And then our threshold standards, I won't dive too much into that since we've already talked about those several times during this presentation. Next slide. Bringing it all together, we really want to harmonize this across all plans within from our bi-state compact to our regional plan and regional transportation plan. Really, climate adaptation and resilience is becoming a part of everything that we do. And we want to make sure that we're integrating it, not creating a separate bucket and a separate plan that sits on a shelf or gets implemented separately from what everyone else is working on. So really harmonizing across our agency's plans and across the basin partnership. Next slide. And we will be developing this resilience framework. So the Tahoe Central Sierra Initiative has developed this really awesome resilience framework. You can see the pillars there. The right half of that circle being those natural resources and the left half being more of those economic and social considerations. So being able to use the EIP to measure and track that right side while having a resilience dashboard and our other climate programs that are tracking the well-being and economic diversity of the region and building that resiliency throughout all of those pillars. Next slide. And finally, how are we doing it and moving forward? And this is maybe an opportunity for this commission to think about how they want to be involved in this process as well. We are obviously regional collaboration is something that we do at TRPA and in the basin very well and all of the time. So through the EIP and the TIE Steering Committee, as I mentioned, that's how we're coordinating across the region and ensuring everyone's moving in the same direction. We're also integrating integrating it within our programs and having adaptive management for climate. We saw Mr. Hester talked about the operations work program. We're also currently working to bring a sustainability code package update forward. So that's definitely something that will come through this commission at some point in the new year. And that can include things like electric vehicle charging station incentives, maybe coverage exemptions for those, increased height allowable for renewable energy generation on rooftops such as solar. There's a lot of different directions we can take that, but we want to make sure our code is the most climate smart and ready that it can be. We are about to select a consultant under Objective 3 for a transportation equity study. We're not only looking at underserved communities in terms of transportation access, but also undue climate burdens on those same populations within the basin. So taking a holistic approach to that engagement in equity. And then obviously using science data and the best monitoring to inform all of these practices and create climate smart goals and thresholds. Next slide. With that, I will turn it back over to you, Mr. Chair, for questions.
Thanks, Devin. Great presentation. We appreciate it. I'm just going to mention one quick thing since you just touched on it. But you and I chatted last week briefly about this, and per California state law, you know, local jurisdictions in California are required to streamline electric vehicle charging station permitting. To that end, we are adopting a new ordinance. And, you know, I guess my question to you is, what do you think the likelihood is for TRPA to consider exempting coverage for new EV chargers that are put in the basin? I think, to me, it would be a great step towards working towards these goals. I mean, of course, we'd like the chargers to go on existing coverage, but we know that's not going to be the case everywhere. And for folks to have to come to, say, the county where we have to issue them a permit for their project per state law, but then for us to direct them to TRPA to go check their coverage, I think, you know, it's poor customer service and a kind of a long process to install something that we're trying to incentivize. So I would just encourage TRPA, if it's possible, to look at exemptions for coverage for new EV chargers.
Yeah, absolutely. That is on our list. I think we've already got in the system coverage exemptions for public utilities in the right-of-way. So there is some sort of precedent there for that electric infrastructure type of thing. Obviously, we do have to examine the environmental aspects of that, but it is on our short list. And I think beyond just the coverage, today we do try to help accelerate electric vehicle permits as much as possible. As you said, with coverage, it's an issue. If an electric vehicle charging station is installed on all existing coverage, we're able to permit that with a QE. So we're able to, like, that at least burdensome permit. And then we get really creative with the coverage. There's multiple projects, EV projects around where that station only takes up 3 or 4 square feet. And if the property is fully covered, we just have them find 3 or 4 square feet of coverage somewhere in the parking lot that's not being used. Really just shift that coverage around on the site. But there's always more that we could do to incentivize and accelerate the permitting on that end. So I think if we can come forward with some code changes, we can follow that with updated permits as well.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much for that. I'm going to turn it over to APC members. Any questions, comments for Devin?
Yeah, Chairman Ferry, I just have a comment. Mr. Middlebrook, thanks for that presentation. And I just want to thank TRPA staff for looking to streamline the permitting process, particularly for EV charging stations. I echo everything Mr. Chairman Ferry said. As you know, the city has we have amended our code to streamline the EV charging stations, and with AB 970, you know, going in effect next year, which actually puts in deadlines for permitting. It doesn't apply to City Salt Lake Tahoe until 2023, but I look forward to working with TRPA staff to help streamline that process so that we can get those EV charging stations permitted in a quick, efficient manner. Thanks.
Thanks, John. Judy, do you have a comment?
Yes, I have a question for Devin. Could you just dolly back that statistic about energy and transportation accounting for 95% of the greenhouse gases? Was pretty disturbing. Can you define what they are? Transportation, I'm thinking, is cars, but does that include boats and that sort of thing? And also, what is in your definition of energy?
Yeah, so you did pick up on that basically 95% of the emissions, greenhouse gas emissions in the Tahoe Basin are from transportation and energy. Transportation, yes, cars, trucks, freight. It does include boating. We do estimate boating emissions. And then the energy sector is electricity and natural gas. So the electricity to power all of our light bulbs and laptops and computers, and the natural gas that people use to heat their homes.
Thank you. I was assuming that, but it's nice to be verified.
Yeah, and that's pretty consistent across both California and Nevada. The one piece that we do not have up here is industry. Industry is a large greenhouse gas emitter statewide in both states, but we don't really have a lot of manufacturing or industry up here, so that's not a major factor.
Construction.
Yeah, general residential construction, those activities are captured.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Judy. Ms. Chandler, please go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. A quick question for Devin. First of all, thank you very much for helping the city to take a major step yesterday in their resolution to be 100% renewable by 2030. A really good job. And I was at the city council meeting, and it was really heartwarming to see so much of our community that is supportive of this initiative and is willing to help move us there. I guess my question to you is, what do you see as the collaboration between the TRPA and the city to help these goals be achieved?
Yeah, absolutely. I think collaborating with all of our local partners is very important. The city this year adopted their climate action plan, and TRPA staff, not just myself, but our transportation team, housing team, multiple team members helped inform and add actions to that climate action plan. So we collaborated with the city in the development of their plans. And then moving forward, I know the city is hiring a sustainability program manager to implement that climate action plan, and I'm sure I will be working very closely with them to help support actions in any way possible.
Thank you.
Thanks, Susan. Other comments?
I'd like to have a comment. This is Eric Young.
Go ahead, Eric.
Hi, thanks so much for the presentation. I always really appreciate these. It makes me feel like I'm really getting insight into something literally kind of cutting edge, and a peek into the future. So I appreciate that. But wanted to let you know that Washoe County is going to be picking a consultant for development of a community mobility plan for our Incline Crystal Bay area. Focus pretty tightly on that small area, but it's an important part of the implementation of our area plan. We're going to be moving forward with that fairly quickly, and I'll probably be asking them to interface with you some to whatever degree our community mobility plan can reflect some of these goals and even some of these techniques of charging stations or whatever else we can do. To help move our part of the basin forward. I'd like them to interact with you. So you'll probably be hearing from our consultant, just to let you know. Ben,
yeah,
I wanted to ask about, in terms of this being kind of setting the bar for other communities, other places. I feel like I should know the degree to which you have a relationship with our own regional planning agency down here in the Truckee Meadows, the TMRPA. They're dipping their foot into some climate initiatives and climate ideas. But it occurs to me that you could really benefit from a relationship with our regional planning agency and vice versa. And as great as it is for places, a long ways away to look at us for best practices, the degree to which you can really just kind of start to spill over the basin into local area jurisdictions, not just the places in the basin that are going to have to pay attention to what you're doing, but you're really close to some really big areas that if they could pick up the ball and even just do a little bit of what we're doing in the basin, it would be meaningful. And so I don't know to what degree just other local jurisdictions, just on the other side of the ridge, so to speak, really understand what you're doing as well as us here inside the basin understand it. But I think it would be, I know you're busy, you got a lot on your plate, but the degree to which places like the Truckee Meadows Regional Planning Agency and other areas like that, Truckee, and could really tie in and start to move the ball forward like you are, that would be really meaningful. So that's my comment. Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate the comment. Always wanting to expand and work with more jurisdictions and partners. I think that's the benefit of the climate program is we are not necessarily bound by the basin boundaries, as you saw with the electric vehicle plan. We went and did expand into Truckee, working with Tahoe Donner PUD to examine that whole system and holistically. So working with Truckee Meadows makes sense because we are in the same watershed. And then we're also, I sit on the organizing committee. I sit on the meetings for a partnership called Sierra Camp, the Sierra Climate Adaptation and Mitigation Partnership, which is hosted at Sierra Business Council, and that works across the entire Sierra on both sides of the state line on climate. So we definitely collaborate in our region. But if there's certain people down in your neighborhood that you think I should be connected with, I'd love to meet them.
Let me add to that, Eric. I'll reach out to Jeremy and tell him that you suggested we contact him at TMRPA. I'm sure some of the APC members do know that we collaborate a lot with the RTC in Washoe County. In fact, they're doing a pilot project that a shuttle from South Reno up to Incline that Catherine Cortez Masto helped get funding for. So we are always looking particularly at our fellow MPOs, our adjacent MPOs, to help us with transportation, because that's such a big part of our emissions. But I'll reach out to Jeremy and see if he wants to meet with Devin and find out more about what we're doing.
I think Jeremy would really appreciate the contact. And I think that both of you would really, I hope, enjoy more of a networking together. So thanks, John. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Chairman?
Mr. Teixeira, go ahead.
Thank you, sir. Devin, thanks for the presentation and congratulations again on being elected mayor of the city of South Lake Tahoe for 2022. Another item on your plate. Very good. On behalf of Tahoe Chamber, I commented yesterday when the city had this aspirational goal of 100% renewable energy, as has been described here. And, you know, the chamber supports that. But we pointed out that there's a lot of work to do to engage the broader community and businesses in getting behind this. I mean, most of the folks here on APC and elsewhere in a lot of the meetings that we all attend, people are pretty educated and understanding of why we need to move in these directions, but it's not necessarily the case in the broader community. One of the things I think that's really good about the APC approach, like the example of APC sort of leading the Tahoe Living Housing Working Group, is that people who are interested, more people beyond the usual folks, have been attending those meetings and asking some very good questions, learning about why the housing initiatives are being undertaken. If we could have a similar approach, again, if the APC can play a role in that and attract more people to the conversation, I think that's really, really helpful, because there's nothing more frustrating than, hey, we know why we're doing this for climate change and this for resiliency, and then we turn around and the community isn't totally on board with that. In fact, there was a woman who called in yesterday who believed that climate change is coming from cosmic debris from outer space. My point is that I think the APC approach as part of the TRPA overall approach does seem to attract more interested people. A lot of people are intimidated talking to the governing board or some of the other, institutions in our community. But the APC does seem to have the ability to attract more folks. So there has to be public and community outreach, including to the business community. But I think having the APC play an active role in attracting folks to learn more about this and offering their opinions would be a positive.
I think that's a good comment, Steve. Thank you. Mr. Gavon has a comment. You're on mute, Eric. There you go.
I'll get it right one of these times. Hey, thank you. Thank you for recognizing me, Chair. Great presentation. I think that one of the things I want to point out, too, on that climate adaptation is the fact that, and you guys have heard me say this, and it came up in our meeting last time about, we need to look at the environment and how we can put these community-wide fuel breaks around. It's one of the things that my chief is really a proponent for. the Tahoe Fire and Fuels team is looking at that, where we can, we've done a lot of defensible space and work in, within the communities, but I think we need to look at some community-wide protection plans and then get those in place ahead of the game. Get them before fires come in so we're not tromping over the environment to save the environment. You know, we do a lot of things and we do these little battles, and we need to win the war. We need to look at it more macro than micro. And so if we say, no, 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 we can't put these in place, and then there's a huge fire, and then we just put them in place in an emergent situation, everybody loses. So I think we need to balance the win-win on that for the environment and the win-win for protecting the communities. So I hope that that will be, going forward, that'll be a priority to adapt to this climate change, because we're going to see more of these fires, and they'll have horrific consequences if we're not proactive. And then lastly, you know, looking at getting on these fires right away and doing that with our helicopter program too, we'll be pushing that forward. And so that's important to look at that, because that will require some give and take. And I think we need to look at that in some of these cases, like we talked about with, you know, coverage and those type of things. Sometimes we have to give a little bit to get a lot. And so we need to look at that. Kind of going back to the old rake the pine needles thing, you know, we get it. We need to protect erosion and that type of stuff, but you can't shoulder the burden on that and then all of a sudden have these catastrophic fires. So a lot's been done with TRPA. I think it's great. I think it's a great program, but I'm going to advocate for those things from a fire perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you've seen, even on this APC, the recent code amendment to allow mechanical thinning on slopes greater than 30% greater than 30% is a big move. And then the Forest Service has started working on funding more uses of traditional washout practices for forest management, which is very exciting as well.
It's huge. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. Other comments? Hearing none, I'm just going to say, Devin, we're definitely going to need your participation. And I know you work closely with Dan Segan, but I've had a few conversations with him as we're, you know, redeveloping these thresholds, integrating climate. One of the categories that's not an EIP category is things like sustainable communities and some of the work, you know, around the built environment. So I think there is still that tension of how do we integrate a lot of these things that are climate change and climate adaptation and climate resiliency efforts into the EIP. How do we fund those things? How do we track those things? How do we get credit for those things? And the more, just from my seat, that we can align with California state law requirements and reporting and tracking requirements, that's really going to help the local jurisdictions not have to do multiple reporting to multiple different agencies as we're tracking these things. So I would just encourage that alignment wherever it's possible with TRPA and the state. I know you're looking at that. I just want to mention it since we're in a public forum here. But I think there's some creative thinking still that needs to be done on how we integrate all these things into the broader kind of EIP umbrella so we can line up those projects and then line up the funding strategies, et cetera. So I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, thanks for those comments. I think that updated resilience dashboard really provides the opportunity to move beyond the what's in, what's out conversation and have that holistic picture. And then I think your comments are reflective of what Jason Berg from the city commented at the TAI steering committee retreat about those same challenges with making sure that our monitoring not only reflects Tahoe, but speaks towards statewide policies and goals.
Yep. Great. Okay. I'm going to open this up for public comment. So to participate in the meeting, go to trpa.gov. In the calendar, click on Advisory Planning Commission, December 8, 2021. There you'll find a link to the public webinar. If any member of the public wishes to address the Advisory Planning Commission at this time, please use the hand-raising function now, and you'll be unmuted by a TRPA staff member. Catherine, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a comment on this item.
Okay. Thank you, Catherine. Any final comments, questions from APC members? Okay, thank you so much, Devin.
Yep, thank you for the detailed discussion and look forward to bringing more more items forward on this topic in the new year.
Yep, thank you. Okay, that information, or excuse me, that item was informational only. So we will move on now to item 5B. This is an update and discussion and possible recommendation on chapter 65 of the Code of Ordinances and section 10.8.5 of the Rules of Procedure for mobility mitigation fee update. Information on this item can be found on page 81 of your packet. And I'm now going to turn it over to Melanie Sloan from TRPA to present. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, Commission members. Melanie Sloan, Senior Transportation Planner with TRPA, here to talk to you today about the mobility mitigation fee update. Next slide, please. Before getting into the recommendation in your packet, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about what brings me here to you today with the update. So back in April, our governing board adopted a new transportation and sustainable communities threshold standard for the region that uses vehicle miles traveled, or VMT. It also adopted the 2020 regional transportation plan with its updated project list. And at the same time, it approved an updated project impact assessment process. And that updated process, it is an effort to implement the new threshold standard at the project level by evaluating a development project's impact to transportation using vehicle miles traveled. And so what remained was to update the mobility mitigation fee. Next slide, please. And so while the fee is an extension of the project impact assessment and its implementation of the new threshold standard at the project level, I want to key in also on the fact that the mitigation fee advances implementation of the regional transportation plan and that updated project list, which includes vehicle miles traveled reducing projects. And it does so because, as many of you are aware, it provides matching funds for projects to receive larger funding to implement the projects within the regional transportation plan. So it's really linking and advancing implementation of the RTP. So when it comes to updating the mobility mitigation fee, to some extent, it's really just updating the air quality mitigation fee, but changing a couple of elements to that. So that air quality mitigation fee, you're likely familiar with, it's been around for a while, has functioned and gained support for its purpose. And the mobility mitigation fee is a name change on one level, but then also it has two elements that it's updating. One is the types of projects that would now be eligible for funding using those funds. And those are VMT or vehicle miles traveled reducing projects. And then also the basis for how the mitigation fee is calculated. The mobility mitigation fee is being based on the vehicle miles traveled generated by a project. So besides the name change, those two pieces are what we're changing to the air quality mitigation fee program, those two components. And it really follows the board's direction that we received back in April, and that was to update the program to integrate with the project impact assessment process, but really be similar to that air quality mitigation fee. And here you can see just what I've said, how we are integrating with the threshold standard and aligning with the regional transportation plan and so forth. But one thing I want to point out as well is the fee, the air quality mitigation fee, hadn't been updated since 2006. And so there was also a real need because of that. With the lack of inflation adjustments, there was lost purchasing power, and also it didn't really align with the updated regional transportation plan. Next slide, please. So now I'm going to talk about how we came to the recommendation before you. First was to identify within the regional transportation plan and its constrained project list, the VMT reducing project costs. And so I mentioned we focused on the constrained project list. So things on the unconstrained list, for example, the waterborne ferry, did not make it into the VMT reducing project costs. Projects had to be capital projects that reduced VMT. And as you know, the regional transportation plan has several regionally important projects, some of which aren't necessarily VMT reducing, but have important elements. Round Hill Pine Resort Intersection Improvement Project is one. It's a needed safety improvement. I'm happy to see that advancing, but it doesn't reduce VMT. So projects like that weren't included in the VMT mitigating project costs. And projects could have a blend of benefits, VMT reducing as well as others. Apache Avenue in El Dorado County is a good example of that. It has great safe routes to school, pedestrian and bicycle improvements, and also some stormwater improvements. Very important, but just not VMT reducing. And so those costs were excluded. And then lastly, if a project has been ongoing and going through multiple phases and funding has been applied, we reduce that so we're not double counting. Next slide, please. And after doing all of those calculations, we result in about $550 million worth of VMT reducing project costs from the 2020 Regional Transportation Plan. Now, we project that VMT from new development will be about 6.8% of future projected VMT. So when we apply that to the VMT mitigating project cost, we result with about $37 million as new development's share of project VMT reducing project costs. Now then, to get us down to a fee rate, we calculate what development's share would be by dividing the proportion of VMT projected from them. And then we do some refinements. As I said, this is an extension of the project impact assessment process and a transition from the air quality mitigation fee program. So we make some refinements to recognize, as the impact assessment process does, that the location of projected development matters to the VMT anticipated to be generated. It also, in the impact assessment process, assumes the full potential impact of transportation for each project. And so when I say that, what I really mean is we anticipate and project most development in our region to be residential and tourist accommodation. So we assume, for example, that those are fully occupied. And lastly, as a transition from air quality mitigation, we continue the approach to apportioning fees. So when a development project comes through, if it's considered to be generating trips and associated VMT, we think of things that generate as, where are the trips starting? Why are they occurring? Well, there's someone in a residential development, or there's someone in a hotel room, for example. And they get apportioned differently than what we call attractors, all those other uses, the recreation and commercial land uses. So once we make refinements for all of those pieces, we come to a recommended fee rate of $218 per VMT. Next slide, please. So the tables before you show estimated fees that would be collected on residential and tourist accommodation unit projects. And you'll see that the fees increase marginally for some and significantly for other project types for three reasons. One is that inflation that I mentioned. We haven't adjusted since 2006. So if you look in the estimated fee in parentheses in the middle column in both of those tables, you'll see what the project would be paying today should we have made those adjustments over time. So some of that is inflation and the change in cost. Other changes, though, are now we're aligned with our RTP constrained project list. Again, the prior program was using a four-year capital project list from 2002 to 2006. And then lastly, location, right? And so as I've mentioned, project impact assessment process was developed and transitioned from trips to vehicle miles traveled to recognize all trips aren't the same and where development occurs matters. And so the mitigation fee is an extension of that approach. Now, also the impact assessment process and the recommended fee also recognizes, but also encourages projects to be located in low VMT areas, such as in or near to our town and regional centers. But it also recognizes VMT reducing strategies, such as project design, mitigation strategies that reduce VMT a project can implement, as well as jurisdiction VMT credit programs. Something not currently in the system, but Placer County, for example, is looking at and considering implementing. So these are all ways that a project's VMT could be reduced. And as that would happen, should those be applied and the VMT is reduced, it carries forward and would be reflected in lower fee rates as well. And just as an aside, we did a quick analysis of the projected development, again, looking at single-family residential development because it represents over 80% of projected development in our region. We found that about a quarter of projected development of single-family residences would be within low VMT areas. Roughly another 50% would be in average VMT generating areas, and then the remaining in higher VMT areas. But it's worth noting that with the implementation of project impact assessment and the alignment with the mitigation fee update, those two together may influence these projections by encouraging development from higher VMT areas into lower VMT areas. And that's the intention. Next slide, please. Additionally, within your recommendation is a waiver for the mobility mitigation fee on deed-restricted, affordable, moderate, and achievable housing when developed in areas eligible for residential bonus units. And that recommendation is consistent with broad support that we received from stakeholders, the public, and governing board members throughout the recommendation process. And just want to say that the impact of the waiver will be linked to the mandated two-year review process associated with the new VMT threshold standard. And so over time, as that review process takes place, should the waiver in the recommendation need adaptations, that process would identify and make recommendations to do so. Next slide, please. Also in your packet are mitigation fund release policy guidelines, and I'm focusing on those here because I think it's of interest to everyone on this as well. Similar to what I've been saying, the mobility mitigation fee is transitioning from the air quality mitigation fee with just a couple of changes, and that most fundamental one is the use for VMT reducing projects. So that's a change in the guidelines. The project types that are eligible to use the funds would need to be VMT reducing. So what does that mean for things like how air quality mitigation fees have been used, funds have been used in the past? Well, projects, for example, like vac trucks or street sweepers, they wouldn't be eligible for mobility mitigation funds, but jurisdictions that have remaining balances of air quality mitigation funds, those projects would still be eligible to be used there. And also there may be other funds such as water quality mitigation that could be applied for those types of projects. And as I mentioned, that's the biggest change between the air quality and the mobility mitigation fee program. So, you know, the other elements such as being able to put about up to 25% aside for operations and maintenance continues, as do other elements. Next slide. And I just want to touch on the engagement, because the recommendation before you was created through a lot of data analysis, but also discussions and input from the development community, including affordable housers, housing developers, transportation consultants, Lake to Save Lake Tahoe, and conversations with staff and jurisdictions. And that was true throughout the draft and final recommendation development, but also is true for implementation. And that's the next step after any action by the governing board. Next slide. So let's talk about next steps. We are here asking for your recommendation, and I'll do the same next week at the operations and governance meeting on the 15th, and then ask for governing board action the same day at their meeting on the 15th. And as I mentioned, implementation follows, and we are committed to continuing our collaboration on implementation of the fee program, and especially with Placer County, with whom also has a transportation fee program that they're updating as well. Next slide. And that concludes my presentation. So I turn it back to you, Mr. Chair, for any questions.
Thank you, Melanie, for that detailed presentation. Really appreciate it. I'm gonna open this up to APC members. And first, I'm gonna go to Mr. Drew.
Good morning. Hi, Melanie. Thanks for the presentation. Can you go back to in the slides to the slide that had the bullets that showed how you calculated the total amount of projects needs and then the fee? Yep, the one just before this.
I think it's two up. This one?
Yes.
Yeah.
So yeah, next one forward. There we go. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are a lot of details and nuances to how you had to do this. And my question is not asking to get into that, but I'm assuming you must have had a number of conversations with the stakeholder groups about how this was calculated. Was there anything significant that came out of those discussions that's worth sharing with this group?
Yeah, Jason, that's a great question. So as I touched on in the engagement slide, we did at multiple phases from draft through final recommendation have conversations with the development community as well as transportation consultants in our jurisdictions to walk through the project list as well as the costs, that determination of the costs to be included. So thinking back on what was included and what wasn't included, and in those calculations, there was feedback at the draft stage about considering and ensuring that we keep the proportional share of projected VMT from development and redevelopment in mind as we come forward to a fee recommendation. Those are all those refinements that I had mentioned to make sure that we were recognizing the project impact assessment process and scaling appropriate to development's impact. We've also worked with our jurisdictions. I mentioned Placer County is advancing their transportation fee update, and that is also incorporating some vehicle miles traveled or VMT reduction elements. So conversations with them to understand how our project lists underlying the two fee programs matched up or overlapped, and that's part of that coordination and implementation that we're continuing to work with them on.
Were there generally, so the, you know, the bottom line, it comes down to the 218 per vehicle mile traveled. I'm assuming at this point that there's general agreement among those groups you met with that number, because it is a really fundamental shift from how air quality mitigation fees were assessed, particularly to development and redevelopment previously.
Yeah, definitely. There was a lot of conversation and discussion about the impact of those fees, but we received support both at the Regional Plan Implementation Committee meetings. We went to them twice, as well as through my direct outreach and engagement with those communities. So generally support for the approach.
Okay. Can you go to the next slide where you show the fees by project? So on this one, I assume that the fees that are proposed on the right-hand side under residential, that these are per residential unit?
That's correct. And while they're proposed, those are estimates. So taking the projected development from our travel demand model and then estimating what the fees would be based on where we projected them to occur. So yes, that is per residential unit.
Could I just add something, Jason? Excuse me, Jason, this is John Marshall.
Yeah,
I just wanted to add on that the fee that all you're setting today is the fee rate, not a project fee. So the amount of VMT that's generated by any particular project will, of course, be site specific and depend on how they compose their project. So the only thing that is before you today is the fee rate, or the 218 per VMT. And then what this chart does is, okay, if it's that rate, let's take some sample projects and see what the fee will be, because the fee is the VMT generated by the project times the fee rate. I just want to make clear that you're not assigning a fee for any particular class of project. It's just the fee rate.
Understood. Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. That's how I took this slide. I was just trying to make sure I understood sort of the estimates that were being shown here in terms of residential. And then for tourist accommodation, are these sort of, example estimates, are these per TAU or just assuming an average tourist accommodation project?
Those are per TAU.
Okay, thank you. And then one last question, you go to the next slide. And then I wanted to reinforce that. I think this is probably one of the most important things that you guys did as a part of this process. This group has spoken a lot about housing and the emphasis on workforce and housing related projects. So I appreciate that a lot of time was spent on this. You know, I've read through this specific part of what's being proposed, and I think there's a lot of value to it. If we want to incentivize these kinds of projects, I think you guys did a good job of finding ways to incentivize them. That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jason. Other APC members.
Hi, this is Eric Young.
Go ahead, Eric.
I want to say I appreciate how many times I was reached out to discuss this. And like I said, I think others were probably reached out to as much as I was. So I want to say that I appreciate that. It is just setting the rate. My understanding through those discussions was that and you can kind of see it here. There was an attempt to be just kind of as straightforward and uncomplicated as possible. It's complicated a little bit by its nature, but really, if you just break it down by its basic math, it's a pretty straightforward approach to trying to establish what the rate is. Now, there were all of those refinements, adjustments. So, well, what about this? What about that? And I think the TRPA staff spent a long time trying to work on those little adjustments here and there to get to something rational and reasonable. The exception for affordable type housing was a big part of the discussion. I do appreciate that, seeing that go forward. I think I'll end just by saying that there's always going to be here some, you know, how we calculate that BMT is going to end up being the next big question, because what I'm experiencing here in Washoe County is a demand for new and interesting kind of projects that I'm not sure how to look at them. For instance, continuum of care based units are, there's a huge demand in Washoe County for them, including in the basin. Other senior type care facilities, I think TRPA calls them residential care, nursing and personal care, land use types. And the promoters of these, when they come forward and they talk to me, they make a really strong pitch about how they just don't have much of an impact on anything in the neighborhood, whether it's traffic or anything else. And that's, you know, they're making that pitch because they need to for various other reasons. But I just want to, I don't need an answer or any kind like that today. I just want to let you know that very soon we're going to have these uses coming to us saying, oh, no, that's not how it really works, you guys. You got to look at us differently. And it's not only going to be these continuum of care type uses. I just think there's a lot of new uses out there that people are going to want us to make little refinements and little adjustments for them. And some of them are going to be extremely rational and make a lot of sense for us to listen. And some are just going to be trying to save some money. So, that's something that you guys are going to have to deal with, I think, going forward. It's not so much what this basic rate is, but a whole handful of different types of uses wanting a special exception. So that's my input. Thank you very much for contacting me along the way. I'm done. Thanks.
Thank you, Eric. Other comments? Ms. Chandler, go ahead.
Yes, I'm just curious. Is there a clear delineation in the definition of what a low, average, and high VMT area is?
That's a great question. So that table, those two tables, we're really just trying to summarize underlying vehicle miles traveled data into some simple buckets of low, average, and high. So it actually doesn't have a specific definition in the project impact assessment or mitigation fee program. It's just looking at are they VMT generating areas that were less than our average or above our average, and kind of summarizing them so we could just take a broad brush, like John Marshall was saying, what fees could be using this fee rate.
So thank you. It was an underlying those calculations of the sample kind of, you know, what projects is obviously the location of the project, because that makes a big difference. And when you apply, when you put your project, your proposed project, into the tool, the individual project, you know, implementation tool for VMT, and you identify where it is, it identifies a specific zone, and that zone has a value attached to it. So that's part of the PIA tool. It doesn't say low, high, medium. It is a specific, you know, numerical value, or correct me if I'm wrong, Melanie, but it's part of the calculus that then the tool spits out to give you your VMT that you could expect from this kind of project.
Yeah, I just think that it needs to be very clearly defined, because the difference in rates is a bit substantial. And I can see in the future you having difficulty saying to somebody that, well, are you in a low or a medium or an average or a high? So I just see it as a potential problem if it's not well defined.
Thank you.
Yeah, good comment. Thank you, Susan. Other members?
I know, sure. Jennifer has. I see Kevin does.
Yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
Thanks, Melanie, for the presentation. I also honor and respect that a lot of time and thought has gone into this proposal. And while it is rational, I think it's really perpetuating more of the same kind of tax the developers logic that goes into most of our environmental policies and has for a long time. And it's a good way for us to get a lot more of what we've been having in the past in the future. And I think there's a real missed opportunity here to look at the triple bottom line effects of these policies. I know this is ostensibly a transportation policy, but it affects redevelopment potential. It affects workforce housing costs. It affects so many other things. And we continue to stack additional fees and complexity on redevelopment that we desperately need. I mean, I'm up here in Kings Beach in Placer County, and you know, only 15% of our commercial lots in Kings Beach even have their VMPs done. So we continue to send untreated stormwater to the lake because no one is incentivized to redevelop. And I feel like this policy, while it has some good features and certainly some good updates from past years, like the exemption for deed restricted, it's really just promoting the same status quo that has gotten us to where we're at today with just dilapidated downtowns and major workforce housing crises. So I think we need a much bigger picture approach to this, and I understand there's a lot of other things in the works, but we really, really, really need to be looking at charging the vehicles that are coming into the basin and driving around the basin themselves, and not the business community who's trying to actually make sure that Tahoe can support a year-round workforce and doesn't just become a wealthy retirees spot and a place for vacations and day-use recreation. I've got real serious economic concerns about where we're at, and I feel like we're at a pivotal time. While there are good features in this, it was a real missed opportunity to engage the business community and those who actually want to put money into the tech centers. And I'm sitting here in Kings Beach looking at just a decade of projects, you know, started, stop, developers fleeing town, people fleeing town. And I'm concerned that we really, there's not a lot of vision and leadership here. This is not really directed at Melanie, really, with all due respect. It's directed at kind of broader leadership here. So I know that's a bit of a high level assessment, but I'm not seeing any real bold action here. We've got 30, 40 years of like car-centric planning policies we need to overcome.
Mr. Chairman?
Thanks, Kevin. Melanie, do you want to respond to that first before I go to you, Steve?
Yeah, if possible, I'd like to just speak to Kevin a little bit. And so first, I want to thank you for sharing your concerns. In the engagement process, I did reach out to the Tahoe Trucking Contractors Association, and as well as those who expressed interest through the Transportation Technical Advisory Committee. which was engaged in the beginning of update to that project impact assessment process that I mentioned was approved back in April. So there were sincere intent and interest in engaging with the North Shore. And I was able to engage somewhat with a fellow developer of yours, Andrew Ryan. But the interest was to get broad input. And I will say, even with the developers that I was able to engage and meet with on multiple occasions, I heard similar things to what you said, the concern for what this impact is for development, making sure that it is truly proportional to their impact in future VMT. And that's what those slides kind of describing how I determined the costs and the proportional share and those refinements to make sure the fee really kept within development's impact and nothing more than that. But even beyond that, I do hear your desire to have this as a bigger picture. And because I'm only talking about the fee rate today, I wasn't able to really talk about that project impact assessment process, which I think if I had that opportunity to talk with you in more detail, which I'm happy to do, you would see that it actually was a pretty thoughtful process to try to recognize our town and regional centers or where we see from a regional plan and through broader policy coordination, the opportunity to concentrate development and to improve for a lot of different metrics, including for reducing vehicle miles traveled. So, you know, a project is evaluated based on its net change in VMT. So when you talk about redevelopment, it's looking at what the VMT or vehicle miles traveled in the current development is versus what would be, and the net difference between them is how those are evaluated. We recognize in our town centers a lot of the development is likely redevelopment. And so it's this net change. And then also we created a screening criteria specifically to our town and regional centers and a half mile buffer around them to further recognize the potential, the regional goals, and the incentivizing just what you're describing, right? Like, we want these things to actually happen. And so they have a higher screening level. And when I say screening level, it doesn't have anything to do with the fee, but it means less additional analysis is required if you are at or below a certain level in town and regional centers. So the intention really is to encourage and align with what I hear you saying. And then I just remind again that we have, especially in the North Shore, with Placer County considering a VMT credit program, we aim to include and recognize a VMT credit program as one of the many ways of reducing VMT generated by a project development or otherwise, or redevelopment. And that's that when I was mentioning, you know, the design as well as location, as well as a project could apply mitigation strategies, as well as should there be a VMT credit program. And those all reduce the VMT and recognize the benefits of that development in that location. And that carries forward to the fee. The fee rate itself, as I said, is really just trying to stay proportional to development's impact.
Gotcha. Thanks for that. Like I said, this is logical and rational and within the constraints of what we've been doing, kind of within the line of thinking of what we've been doing in the past, there are incremental improvements. I just think it falls way short of what we really need, which is major parking reform and really addressing the issue of VMT head on, like with the actual vehicles themselves, not just the development community, particularly because this accounts for such a tiny drop in the bucket of the real transportation funding that we actually need. Yet it adds a ton of complexity and perpetuates the same kind of rigorous environmental review process and costly redevelopment. So again,
yeah,
a bit of high level frustration I'm expressing, not so much with what you brought forward today. I just want to make sure that we're on public record talking about this today, because I think.
And I appreciate that, Kevin, and I thank you for saying that. You also gave me an opportunity just to flesh out the rest. I talked about future VMT with development representing 6.8% of projected future VMT. That remaining amount is really being addressed through the regional transportation plan and its broader implementation. And so we don't look to this fee to reduce all of that, just development's proportional share. But as you know, there's a regional and sustainable revenue discussion going forward to try to identify ways of funding the regional transportation plan in full, as well as the regional transportation plan's typical funding through state and federal grants and so forth. So I do hear you. There is an issue of VMT beyond development's impact, and just want to be clear that the regional transportation plan and efforts around that are aimed to tackle the remaining 93-ish percent.
Thank you. Mr. Teixeira, did you want to jump in on that?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Kevin, thank you for bringing up those issues. The big picture, the doing something different, and you know, being an advocate on behalf of a couple of clients, including the Tahoe Chamber. And I want to thank Melanie. She did reach out to the development community. At least I was in plenty of those meetings, and the chamber as well. But the big thing that we were looking at, so that we're not just always going to the development and redevelopment community for funding transportation. Yes, there are other grants and stuff. What really is the regional revenue process? So we had a lot of faith that both in advocating and supporting the regional transportation plan adoption last year, and then in dealing with this issue on the mobility mitigation fee, we had a lot of hope that there would be a robust process around identifying some really substantial transportation funding sources that would take, you know, into account the fact that day use is driving a lot of our VMT and the congestion that we have. And sadly, at the moment, I am concerned that the regional revenue source process is faltering. You know, there's not a lot of consensus around what should be done. The states are saying, hey, it's up to you locals. And the locals are saying, hey, we need help from the states. And there's sort of a standoff right now. So that does leave exposed, you know, the development community to, hey, here is something we're doing. And it kind of doesn't have the other pieces that I think are really needed. So I was going to ask Melanie to describe the relationship between, you know, I think there's still provisions in here to say if the regional revenue source is successful, then the development community fee will be either reduced or won't go up substantially. Or I think there is some relationship in there. Maybe Melanie, you could describe that so we get that on the record.
Yeah. So thanks for your comments, Steve, and I do appreciate all the input and guidance you provided through development of the fee rate recommendation for the commission today. So the regional revenue, as I was saying to Kevin, is one effort in recognizing implementation of the broader regional transportation plan beyond development's proportional share. And so I just repeat that the development of the fee rate is really linked and tied to the projected development VMT. So not any of that day use or any of the broader VMT discussion, but really what's projected from development. So the fee rate kind of represents that. I know when we did meet, you expressed concern and the same as you said today about the status and process for the Sustainable Revenue Initiative. And I know that is an ongoing effort and it's a complex matter, but it is a bit distinct from development. We won't, there's no intention nor language to increase the fee rate should the Sustainable Revenue Initiative not be advanced, because the fee rate is truly linked to projected development's future VMT.
Well, I appreciate that. I wanted to get that on the record. And, you know, we're grappling a little bit here with the same sort of silo discussion we had earlier today on the previous item, where things are siloed and they're not really connected. And, you know, my concern, having been, you know, at Tahoe for nearly 50 years, is that the development community is an easy, visible target that has been a target. You know, there are relationships, yes, but they've been a sort of an easy target. And yet the bigger deal is the continuing day use increase and pressure on Tahoe, and the inability to figure out how to get those people to participate. And so while we have a hard time figuring out that, the development community continues to be, you know, a visible and traditional target. And I think that's part of what Kevin was touching on. And I also agree with what Eric Young said earlier, that, you know, that the agency is going to be under a lot of pressure. I need an exemption for this. I need an exemption for that. So it'll be an interesting process going forward. And the final thing I'll add, having got some of these things on the record, is that for many of us, including I think many of us here today, you know, the waiver for the affordable housing projects that meet the definition, that was huge, because you know, if that was going to be another cost on affordable housing projects, that would have been very much counter to what we're trying to do in other areas of the work that we're doing here in Tahoe. But Melanie, you've been great. You have this fantastic ability to listen to criticism and to not take it personally and to try to incorporate it into the work you're doing as best you can. And that's commendable. Thank you.
Agreed. Thanks, Steve. I'm going to go first to Ms. Jacobson and then Pitch, I'll go to you. Go ahead, Crystal.
Thank you, Brendan. And thank you, Melanie, for bringing this forward and for all the work. I know you reached out to me, too, and so I appreciate that. And then I also just want to echo some of the comments about the waiver, you know, the recommendation for the waiver on deed-restricted housing. It was good to see that in the proposal. I just want to point out, you know, you talked about how Placer County is, you know, we're currently updating our fee program as well. And I think, as mentioned in, you know, your staff report package, we're the only jurisdiction in the basin that has an adopted fee program. We are currently updating that fee program, and a little further along, I think, than what was noted in the staff report. We're actually headed to our board next week on that. And what we're doing is updating it. The update was a result of our board's adoption of a VMT threshold. And so the intent of the update is to include VMT reducing projects similar to what you're doing here, which is great. I think our concern is, and I know, Melanie, you know, you've met with our staff. Our concern is that there appears to be kind of an overlap of the projects, right, that would, the VMT reducing projects that are on your list and our list. And so we have concern about that overlap and what that means for, you know, for our applicants, right, and paying their fair share. And so I think that we, you know, we would like to see a little bit more certainty around that and kind of flesh that out a little bit more before this moves forward, I would say. And I'm not sure what that looks like, but would like to resolve that. I also just want to point out, too, we like to express just the importance of regional distribution of project costs, just to make sure that in general, you know, folks are paying their fair share for regional projects that have basin-wide benefits. So, you know, the county's done a lot in mitigating, you know, traffic impacts and, you know, a little bit, I don't want to say ahead of the game, but we've had this transportation fee program in place. We have been reinvesting those dollars into projects and programs that reduce, you know, or mitigate impacts. And then now focusing on this, you know, reduction of VMT, which is, you know, very new. We're not doing this anywhere else in the county. And so excited about including VMT reducing projects on our list. But just, we really do want to make sure that, you know, when projects are contributing their fair share, that there's no overlap here. And so that's definitely an area of concern for us and something that I think we'd like to see resolved prior to this moving. And then I did have just a couple questions related to the mitigation fund release policy. It looks like that's not being adopted in the resolution, and it's perhaps just a guideline document for staff. I guess that would be my first question. I don't know if you want to answer that first or if I should just keep rolling.
Well, I was going to defer to John Marshall, so if we want to answer now, I defer to him on whether it needed to be part of the resolution.
Crystal, why don't you go ahead and get all your questions?
Yeah, good. So the questions had to do with, you know, there's one policy in here about the monies, the funds going towards shovel-ready projects. And so, you know, being guidelines, I don't know if there's any sort of flexibility in that, because a lot of times the grants that we're going after, you know, we need to come up with matching dollars to cover things like environmental review or design and feasibility studies. And so if there's an opportunity to provide some more flexibility in how those funds could be used for us to, you know, particularly on these larger state or federal grants that come forward, and we're going after them, and we're trying to come up with you know, we have trouble coming up with matching funds, right, to cover those other costs. So I would just want to ask about that or make that comment that it would be great if there could be more flexibility in that. And then the second thing had to do with the last item in the guideline about restrictions. And maybe I just have sort of a question on that. If you could maybe clarify that a developer would not be responsible to pay a fair share over and above what they might sort of provide in a build construction associated with those that project list. So a lot of times our conditions of approval for, I would say most of the time, the conditions of approval on projects are actually mitigation, and it's the developer paying a portion of their fair share towards that project. So if you might provide some clarification on that, that would be great.
Okay, am I off mute? Yeah. Let's see if I can quickly address a couple of those and then turn it back over to Melanie. So you'll see on page 82 of your packet, you are not adopting and not recommending adoption of the guidance. So you'll know that we also put out today our packet for the governing board, and it's the same motion. So we are not seeking approval of the guidance as an official document. Melanie, do you want to go ahead and take on the specific questions, and I can follow on if I feel like there's a need to clarify anything?
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be great, John. I appreciate it. So, Crystal, thank you so much for bringing forward your thoughtful review and conversation. I'm going to start with the questions, and then I'll wind back to some of the initial discussion about the two fee programs. So, regarding the distribution guidelines and shovel-ready projects, we did hear from your colleagues at Placer County that just what you said, that there are perhaps project level environmental aspects to an otherwise shovel ready or shovel-ish ready project. So we did make modification to the language in the distribution guidelines to try to address that concern. As I look at that shovel ready project discussion, there is a bit of recognition of, and I'm trying to quote here directly, shovel-ready projects, for example, project-level environmental review, preliminary engineering design, construction phase, et cetera. That was our intent to try to recognize that as it was originally written in separating environmental from the shovel-ready implementation, that there may be a few of those elements that the funds could help to advance. And that's what I was hearing from you. So that was our intent to try to address that. Secondly, we also heard the comment about the fair share and making sure in that restrictions section that it recognizes that that the funds can't be used as for mitigation measures that are part of a project approval. But and this was the recommended language, and I think it makes sense. And I checked with our current planning staff, and well, it was a real clarification, so thankful for that edit. The clause was ended to the end, you know, if a project is required to fully fund implementation of the mitigation measure. So that, again, was our intent to respond to some really good feedback about being clear and making sure that, that fair share in those fund use and restrictions was in place. So before I go back to those other points, I just want to make sure that was clear and see if you have any questions.
Yeah, no, that's good. It's I assumed that these weren't being adopted. So, no, that's good. Great.
Okay, great
clarification. Thank you.
Wonderful. Glad we could respond to those. They were really good and helped advance the guidelines to be more clear. So going back to the two fee programs, I think I'd like to start in what you said. Placer County is the only jurisdiction in the region with its own fee program and has had that in place for several years. Concurrent with our air quality mitigation fee program. So we've been running parallel fee programs in the region for quite a bit. To some extent, they have overlapped and had similar purposes, and they continue to do so under the updated Tahoe transportation fee that's proposed from Placer and the mobility mitigation fee that we're proposing updating today. And I think we at TRPA feel like we can continue to collaborate and make sure that they align but don't overlap in a way that's detrimental to development. I think that that commitment to continue to work with your colleagues, in fact, we are still doing so because, as I mentioned in my presentation, the next phase after adoption is implementation, and this ability to recognize the two programs and make sure they work in concert and align and don't overlap, an implementation approach we're committed to finding a solution to as well. So that's my response. If John, you have things you'd like to add to that, or Crystal, you have additional questions or comments, I'm happy to hear them.
I have nothing to add other than to really emphasize that, Crystal, a lot of the issues we see with trying to streamline and combine both programs as implementation details rather than the adoption of the fee rate and the waiver that are the specific actions before you today.
Understood. Thank you.
Thanks, Crystal. Those are good local jurisdiction comments. I appreciate you raising them for all of us. Mr. Hitchcock, you had a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Melanie, great presentation, and you know, thank you for including us in this process. I said clarification that the mobility mitigation fee does not apply when you're doing redevelopment of using existing development rights on the ground, whether it's commercial floor area, existing residential future use, or existing tourist accommodation uses. Is that correct? That only applies when there's actually an increase in capacity, new units of use, new CFA, and new tourist accommodation units?
Yeah, John, that's a great point, and I'm glad you're bringing it up because it's a key detail in the implementation. As I was talking to Kevin earlier, when it comes to redevelopment, or when I was using the redevelopment discussion, the impact assessment is on the net change in VMT. So if the change doesn't generate new VMT, the mobility mitigation fee would have no charge there. In a redevelopment situation, if the new use is a greater VMT producer than the old use, then there would be a charge. But if it's a reduction in VMT, the fee wouldn't apply there. So it is, in a certain sense, the change has to generate a change in an increase in VMT.
Thank you.
Thanks, John. Other members, comments, questions?
I have one final comment, Eric Young.
Go ahead, Eric.
I agree that this isn't like a paradigm shift. Like we were talking about the larger, bigger opportunities that some members would like to see. I think I may like to see some of those things as well. I'm not sure that was part of Melanie's charge in this effort. But what it's making me think is, Brendan, if you're thinking about the APC's role, just this discussion here showing that the APC is, we're all able to talk to each other in professional ways, have real conversations with each other. You've got a moment here in time, Brendan, when you've got a board that can have these difficult conversations and that can raise unpleasant topics and things that people have struggled to raise before. This group seems to be able to do it with each other in a professional, respectful way. So that's something that I'm noticing. And in your efforts to figure out what the future of the APC could be, these discussions like this where difficult things are raised is something we're good at, and we might should be encouraged to do more. I would say that one of those things I might bring up is that fees accomplish a couple of purposes. They're needed for revenue. If we set fees to generate revenue, and we set fees to drive and shape behavior. And I think whenever you establish a fee and you're having a discussion of what that fee should be, you should have a really good grasp of both reasons. You should understand, like we're doing here, about how to get fair share established and what that fee should be in order to meet the revenue needs. But you should also have a really clear understanding of what kind of behavior you're trying to shape and drive by that same fee, And I think you should also always ask yourself, if other revenue became available and we didn't need this for revenue any longer, would we still do it to drive and shape behavior? Is it still necessary to have this fee if we didn't need it for the revenue? So those are, I don't need answers or questions, but I just appreciate this board being the type of board that can grapple difficult things to think about in a respectful and professional way. And Brennan, I hope that you're able to take advantage of that moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric, for that.
Brendan?
John, do you want? Yeah, go ahead, John.
I just wanted to respond to one thing. Great comments, Eric. I do think that I want to emphasize that this fee is not for revenue generation in the abstract to pay for the RTP. It is a mitigation fee. So there is each project, if they're subject to this fee, is going to be generating additional VMT that needs to be mitigated to achieve our thresholds. And so it is not a way to drive revenue generation. It's a way to allow these projects to proceed while mitigating their impacts that they have. So I just wanted to make clear that you are not approving a revenue generation fee in general. You are approving a mitigation fee that allows individual projects to move forward if they don't have an opportunity to otherwise mitigate their increase in VMT, either with their own projects or designing their projects in such a way as to minimize the generation in the first instance. This is an opportunity to allow projects to move forward that are generating additional VMT, generating an impact, and trying to find a way that does both those things that Eric talks about. I would say not generating revenue, but mitigating their impact and setting up the fee in such a way that it directly recognizes that different projects, depending on their location, types, et cetera, have different impacts. So we're truly talking about a mitigation fee here that, together with other sources of money and revenue, go towards the implementation of the RTP, which allows us to say these projects, if they pay this fee, can mitigate and proceed without requiring direct per project mitigation. So it's really an in-lieu fee for mitigation purposes that we're talking about. And I'll get off my mitigation horse and allow you to discuss.
No, that was great, John. I really appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think that's a good clarifying comment, John. Mr. Drew, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, just one thing on what John just brought up. I think that is a good clarification. I do think it's important to recognize and why I wanted to go back to those tables earlier. And if you think about what Kevin said and what Steve brought up, one of the things, and I'm bringing this up because I think this is important as this moves forward to governing board committees and then ultimately the governing board, is the challenge we face is these fees have to be paid up front. And if you're thinking about, one of the major emphasis in the regional plan update was environmental redevelopment. And one of the challenges we found since the regional plan has been adopted is, as you all know, there's not been an overwhelming number of redevelopment projects because it's still extremely challenging and extremely expensive. Even a small project of a 40-unit tourist redevelopment project is going to have to pay on the order of potentially $500,000 before they can put a shovel in the ground. And I think the reality of that is when these things are all layered on top of each other, and Kevin, this may be what you were getting to, is you start to layer these things on top of each other. And I've spent enough time talking with potential project proponents who come and think about wanting to do a project here. And it's just overwhelming. They're in the millions of dollars of upfront money before sometimes they even know they have a project approved or can put a shovel in the ground. And so I think it's important that layering that Kevin brought up, and then how these things link together and what that means for actually achieving the goals in the regional plan. It's obviously very complicated, There's a lot of layers to it. Melanie pointed that out as in some of the slides that she presented. So there's certainly no simple answer, but I do think it's important to get on the record as a part of our recommendation for the governing board committee and the governing board to think about is the things happening outside of this particular area and what that means for actually getting projects on the ground.
Thanks, Jason.
Mr. Chair?
Steve?
Just wanted to add one thing. I appreciate Councillor Marshall's perspective on the mitigation. And again, my point is just that there's a lot of impacts that are going unmitigated. Bay use at Tahoe is one of them. So that's.
Yeah, I just want to make certain.
The people that are easy to grab, it's harder to grab the people that are not so easy to grab. And that's the big, bold thing that we need to do that we haven't done to date. So thank you.
Yeah. I just want to make certain that we stay on our agenda topic.
I understand.
Move into regional revenue.
Right. Yeah, I know. It's a silo thing, though.
Vice Chair Carr has some comments. Jennifer.
Kevin, did you want to follow up on that thread before I jump in?
I just wanted to ask if we could put a finer point on Steve's question about could this mitigation or mobility mitigation fee be revisited should we have a massive change in regional or even zonal revenue options? Because I think right now all I see in this proposal is that it's going to go up each year, not only to keep up with inflation, but I think 2023 there's a trigger, and if there isn't regional revenue in place, then it could go up substantially, which I think only has huge economic negative impacts. So I would vote that if that isn't explicitly in here, that be part of our recommendation, that it maybe is revisited with that in mind to either reduce it. I'm not saying it needs to completely go away, but it's just adding, it's layering upon layering, like Jason was saying. So,
just to kind of respond in a generic sense, that this fee is part of our programs that are looked at with the new VMT threshold, sustainable communities threshold number one. Is examined in some ways every 2 and every 4 years. And so the funding question often doesn't, it's not going to be, probably evident within 2 years or 4 years of how that big puzzle of larger RTP funding will come in. But over time, there is opportunities to relook at that equation and say, yes, hey, we don't need as much from from local sources, that pie. But often, remember, the way that this fee is used is for a local match. This fee, in the big picture, this fee doesn't generate all that much money for local jurisdictions. What did we calculate for Placer County? It's $50,000 a year, maybe. Mm-hmm. So the charge that's actually aggregated is not all that much, and it's used to be the local match for federal projects and state projects, which brings in a lot more money. So the fee is leveraged, highly leveraged, to make additional funding possible. So on the one hand, we want to make sure we don't get rid of that opportunity for local match. There may be other ways to generate that money, Kevin, and Placer County, I think, is exploring some of those options so that your fee actually will go down, because your impact, it has been mitigated by other locally generated projects. So I think there's opportunities to look at that, but I do think it needs to be done with eyes wide open as to how the total funding picture is accomplished for implementation of these RTP programs. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, good point.
Yeah, that is a good point, John. Anyone else want to weigh in right on this topic before we go to Jennifer? Okay, take it away, Jennifer.
All right. Well, and I had actually had sort of a thought or question related to this, and so I'll jump in on that first here at the end, because what John said about this being essentially a mitigation bank or an in lieu fee for projects that can't be mitigated at the project level makes some sense, because I was struggling with how these small fees at, you know, $3,000 or $10,000 or $15,000 at a time would get to the $37 million target on the long-term planning horizon, because that would take a heck of a lot of projects to generate $37 million worth of funding with these small amounts of money. So understanding that I know you had to have a number to work towards in order to figure out what fee to propose, but that $37 million makes it sound like a revenue generating function versus what John was saying about it being, you know, explaining further about it being a mitigation bank. And Melanie, I know that other parts of your presentation talk about how it functions as a mitigation bank and how you have the flow chart of projects where, you know, basically someone can mitigate within their own project and avoid the fee altogether if they go down that path. It will be interesting to see over time whether this fee is enough of an incentive to get people to do those mitigating projects at the project level, or if even those mitigations that they might construct or whatever are so expensive, it's actually cheaper to just pay the fee. And then, so it's not actually mitigated at the project level. So I know it's a little too soon to tell, because the whole structure of this was just approved in April, and this is sort of part two to go with it. So it's going to have to prove out. But those will be some interesting things, I think, to kind of watch in the future is how these projects actually start to unfold with these different options they have available to them. One of the things I noticed that might go a little bit to this incentive for redevelopment too is that it's not really, it was a $218 of VMT. It's a 90-10. So it's actually $196.20 for residential or TAU. But if you're redeveloping a commercial floor area, it's only $20.80. So it might actually incentivize some of that commercial floor area or some of those town center type activities that would actually be fairly maybe inexpensive, potentially at deference to not building residential housing, which is more expensive. I don't know exactly how that's going to play out either. But one of the things that might be helpful is to also include in future presentations, maybe an example of what a fee might look like for a commercial floor area at that $21.80 value. I think you said in your staff report that was difficult to find a representative project and what that might look like, but that it is parsed out in your staff report as sort of two different fees, and there might be some effect there as well. I'll stop there before I have go on to my other questions about the staff report.
Thanks, Jennifer, for those comments. I think they're all really good points and duly noted on how to improve discussion and explanation of the fee program.
Okay, so on the staff report itself, one minor thing. In the background section, you refer to Nevada Senate Bill 256. I think that's a typo. I couldn't find a Senate Bill 256 related to this topic in the last three sessions. But when I looked at Executive Order 2019-22, I think you meant Senate Bill 254. But there was also another Senate bill referenced in that executive order, which was Senate Bill 358. So you might want to just take a look at that. It sounds like maybe the governing board packet's already gone out, but in clarifying the record, I think the right Senate bill needs to be identified there. And as I mentioned in the past, and this is just maybe a suggestion for TRPA, in just editing their documents in general, you know, it's always helpful to put a year on your Senate bills, like SB 256-2019, because there's always a Senate Bill 256 every 2 years. And so tracking down that history in this context, especially since it wasn't just this last session, is a recommendation just going forward. I had a question about the annual inflation adjustments based on consumer price index for San Francisco. And I see that that was a governing board provision from April. If you know, I'm curious why San Francisco was picked for the consumer price index. And then secondarily, I didn't see this in the rules change. There's no mention of annual increases based on the CPI for San Francisco. So, do you want that to happen automatically, or were you planning on bringing your rules back every year or every couple of years to make that annual inflation adjustment on the fee?
Okay. Thanks for those two edit suggestions. I'll look back and clarify on the bill and add the year of the bills. That's really helpful to know for this, and as you said, future staff reports. So I appreciate you taking that fine-tooth comb and sharing that. Regarding the inflation adjustment, and it was part of the project impact assessment update, and CPI for San Francisco, I'm trying to go back into my memory. So John, if you have a memory as to why that was chosen, I think it aligns with the CPI we use for other fee updates at TRP, but I'm not sure if that, yeah, he's nodding his head. That's my recollection, is that we were aligning with how we update our other fees and charges, which is a good segue to your last point. It's not in the rules of procedure change. What it is an administrative process that I'm working to have synced up with TRPA's update process to the other fees and charges that we have, so that it becomes something that isn't overlooked in future years like the air quality mitigation fee had been. So it would be part of the administrative process, and I think that all syncs up with the choice of inflation.
Okay, thank you. So to that end, I'm curious, because we're also figuring out how to index our fees so that they change over time as well without necessarily having to go back for regulation amendments all the time. Is that something that you do have to edit and redo on your rules documents, or is that something that you just update like on your website? Where does the public know what the current fee is when they are annually adjusted?
It is on our website, Jennifer, when those fees are updated. We do bring, you know, we do update our general fees for inflation, and using that index or one that makes more sense. And so it was last governing board meeting that they adopted that. And so we can send you that staff report that might give you some background on how we adjust for inflation. I believe the code already, as a result of the amendments in April, already authorized the automatic adjustment for CPI. So we don't need any additional authority to do that. Actions to the governing board through the operations committee, and then the adjusted fee rates are published on our website.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. So yeah, I guess it's just a reminder that not everything the governing board considers comes through the APC. So that's helpful. It's just something we don't see, but I appreciate that. I might be interested just on a personal level with the documentation that you're talking about, just so that we might apply it here. We can do that sidebar though. Let's see. I think the last question I had was about the equivalent fees of peer communities. You do talk in your discussion on page 83 about how those were considered, but not necessarily used to set the fee. But it looks like you did some benchmarking. It does say that the staff report says they're reasonably close. So I was just wondering what that benchmarking sort of looked like. Were they, like areas like Sacramento, and you know, were they like $300 or 202 or just broad? I mean, without getting too deep into the weeds on very specific examples, I'm just looking for a little bit other information on where this fits on a benchmarking perspective.
Yeah, so Jennifer, I can speak to that. So we did take a look at pure community fees. We looked at Placer County, both within the region and their West Slope fee. We looked at the town of Truckee, El Dorado County, and then also RTC Washoe to understand how fees were charged and to try to make some equivalency of what the fee rate would be to what we're proposing, a VMT-based fee. And the recommended fee kind of sat about right in the middle of what was there. With that said, Placer's updating their fee rate, and so how that's represented on the table was what was information that was available at the time of the equivalency evaluation. But it sits right about in the middle. The thing to remember, though, and the more detailed information is in the policy paper attached to the packet, should you want to go into the details a bit more. The thing to remember is many of those fees actually reflect not the mitigation elements that John Marshall was clarifying earlier, but become something of a revenue generator, that difference between what we're doing with this fee and what those other fees were doing. For example, in the West Slope of El Dorado County, their fee is to recognize impacts to their transportation systems, such as roadways and signals and things like that. That's to generate income to then provide those infrastructure needs that new development will require. And so that is different than the VMT mitigating approach. And so it was a bit of an apples to orange comparison in most cases, but it was, you know, constructed to get as close as we could to what an impact would be using VMT of the various fees.
All right, thank you.
Good comments, Jennifer. Thanks. Any other APC members? I was just going to ask one question about the mitigate. You know, if a project could mitigate their way out of paying this fee, is there consideration for electric vehicles in that? Is there any differentiation between EVMT and VMT? Or are they the same?
Yeah, it's a great question, Brendan, especially coming on the heels of Devin's great presentation prior to mine. So the thing about vehicles is they produce vehicle miles traveled, whether they're electrically generated or combustion engine generated. So our current mitigation strategies don't recognize that as a reducing VMT strategy. But I think as Devin was talking to and John Hester was introducing the work, that, you know, there are definitely other ways that we are thinking and going to be thinking about recognizing, you know, e impacts on our region, and perhaps not in the VMT realm, but I can see other areas recognizing and advancing that.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's something that's going to be interesting to track over time and see how maybe there is a shift between combustion engine and electric vehicles that we should start capturing. I really appreciate the mitigation fee discussion, because that is a really important source of funding for local jurisdictions, and it is how we accomplish a lot of our projects, bike paths, purchasing sweepers, other things that do mitigate impacts. And so that's just really important for us. And I have to echo the affordable housing exemption. I think that's just absolutely critical. So thank you for that. I'm going to open this up for public comment now. To participate in the meeting, go to trpa.gov. In the calendar, click on Advisory Planning Commission, December 8, 2021. There you'll find a link to participate on GoToWebinar. If any member of the public wishes to address the Advisory Planning Commission, please use the hand-raising function now, and you'll be unmuted by a TRPA staff member. Catherine, over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a comment on this item.
Okay. Any final thoughts from APC members? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Sorry, go ahead.
I don't know if we need to make sure it's on the record in some other way, but although Mr. Wilkins didn't speak up during public comment. He did send us a letter through TRPA in support of the waiver for deed-restricted housing. And he represents Remy Moose and Manley. It looks like a law firm.
Yes, thank you so much for mentioning that, Jennifer. Hopefully everyone saw that in their email boxes. We got that late last night. Thank you for that. With that, we do have three motions to make, and I guess I have a question on this. If we go ahead and make the motions, is there a way, John, that we can pass on to the governing board some of the flavor of, I guess I'm just asking, the motions are pretty straightforward, but we've had a lot of other discussion here. Is there a way to pass on our discussion points and nuances to our recommendation to the governing board outside of just giving them our meeting minutes?
Yeah, and unfortunately, we won't be able to do that given that we only have a week. You know, the board meeting is next Wednesday. But in general, in these situations, staff can and does provide a summary of the APC recommendation, and we can include, you know, a sense of the discussion. It as part of the presentation, I think, you know, a lot of the points that Kevin was bringing up and echoed by others can be provided, you know, in the context of we need to look at generally how we assess mitigation fees and the impact on you know, the business community, et cetera. So we can do that when we provide the recommendation from the APC, but there will be no written product because that's already, we're a little late on that because of the timing of these November, December meetings.
Okay. So Melanie, you could convey our messages in your presentation to the governing board.
I think Susan has a...
Yeah, is it possible to make a motion with reservations and then list the reservations?
Susan, I think that's a little difficult in our system.
Okay, just curious.
You know, I think if there's a reservation, it would mean that the motion would be, you could frame your motion in such a way that you would not, you know, recommend a particular item, if that was your desire. So it wouldn't be so much with a motion with reservations, but in, you know, the motion itself would say, yeah, I don't know exactly what you're thinking about, but, you know, I would make it in the form of your motion, not so much a specific reservation, because your action that you'd be taking would be to approve the recommendation or something else.
Thank you.
And if I recall correctly, it wasn't that long ago, maybe a year ago, there was an item there was quite a bit of discussion on as well. And I think at least one of the local jurisdictions appeared at the governing board to voice some of those concerns and some of the discussion from the APC as well. So, you know, obviously that's an option because those governing board meetings are also open and public and transparent. So, you know, Kevin, Crystal, you know, might be an option for you as well. I'm confident in the TRPA staff conveying the discussion. But Crystal, I think as you were saying something, you sort of tailed off where you said you'd like to see it resolved prior to moving forward. And unless you're going to vote no or make a motion that espouses that today, I don't know that that desire of yours will make it into these resolutions, but certainly could be brought to the governing board directly for your jurisdiction.
And remember that we have a jurisdictional member from each jurisdiction on the governing board. So Supervisor Cindy Gustafson is on our governing board, and we have, you know, she is well aware of these issues. And so, you know, she will also, I'm sure, be communicating with her staff. And so it's, Jennifer, there's also that representation on our board from each local jurisdiction.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's really good discussion, just so we're all aware. But yes, it is an open meeting. And Kevin, if you feel the need to go to the governing board and express your concerns there as well, you certainly have that right. So with that, we have three motions to make. They're on the screen. Would anyone care to make the first motion?
This is Susan. I'm willing to make the first motion. I would like to move to recommend adoption of the findings, including a finding of no significant effect, as set forth in Exhibit 1.
Thank you, Susan. Anyone care to second that motion?
I'll second that.
Was that Jennifer?
Yep.
Thank you, Jennifer. Okay, Tracy, I'll hand it to you for a roll call vote, please, on motion number 1.
Mr. Young?
Yes.
Mr. Hitchcock?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
I am unable to bring myself to vote in the affirmative, nor do I wish to vote no, so I'm going to abstain on this and the other two motions as well.
Thank you. Ms. Jacobson?
I'm also going to abstain, and I'll just make the comment that I feel like the fee is based on a project list. The project lists go into the fee, and I just, understanding that we've got overlap in Placer on the projects, again, I would just hope to see some resolution on the project list before moving it forward, so I'm going to also abstain.
Ms. Simon?
Yes.
Mr. Drew?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Drake?
No.
Ms. Ferris?
Yes.
Ms. Chandler?
Yes.
Mr. Gavon?
Yes.
Mr. Smokey? Ms. Carr?
Yes.
Mr. Booth?
Yes.
Mr. Alling? Mr. Ferry?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, that motion passes.
Thank you, Tracy. Anyone care to make the second motion?
I'll make the motion, Eric Young.
Go ahead, Eric.
Recommend adoption of Ordinance 21-dash to be filled in, amending Ordinance 2019-03 as previously amended to amend the Code of Ordinances as set forth in Exhibit 3.
Thank you, Eric. We have a second?
This is Susan. I'll second.
Thank you, Susan. Tracy, roll call vote, please.
Mr. Booth?
Yes.
Ms. Chandler?
Yes.
Mr. Drake?
Abstain.
Ms. Carr?
Yes.
Mr. Drew?
Yes.
Mr. Gavon?
Yes.
Ms. Jacobson?
Abstain.
Ms. Ferris?
Yes.
Mr. Hitchcock?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Simon?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Abstain.
Mr. Young?
Yes.
And Mr. Ferry?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, that motion passes.
Thank you, Tracy. And we have a third motion. If anyone would care to entertain that one.
Eric Young, I'll make a motion to recommend adoption of the resolution 21- to be filled in to amend the rules of procedure as set forth in Exhibit 4.
Thank you, Eric. Second by anyone?
I'll second that, Mr. Chair. Jennifer Carr.
Thank you, Jennifer. And last roll call vote, Tracy, please.
Mr. Hitchcock?
Yes.
Mr. Young?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Abstain.
Ms. Jacobson?
Abstain.
Ms. Simon?
Yes.
Mr. Drew?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Drake?
Abstain.
Ms. Ferris?
Yes.
Ms. Chandler?
Yes.
Mr. Gavan?
Yes.
Ms. Carr?
Yes.
Mr. Booth?
Yes.
Mr. Alling? And Mr. Ferry?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, that motion passes.
Thank you, Tracy. Thank you, Melanie. Really appreciate it. Thank you to all members for the robust discussion. I think that's exactly what we're here to do. So thank you for your engagement. It's a great example of why we're all on this committee. Okay, I'm going to move us along. It's 12:16. I'm sure people are getting hungry. We haven't taken a break yet, but let's go quickly to item 7, which is reports. And I'm going to pass this over to John Hester for the Executive Director report, including your quarterly report and upcoming topics.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You had asked that we report on items you took action on and what happened at the governing board. You took no action on items last month that the governing board had to act on. But I think Kim Carringer gave you a report on the items the previous month. So the governing board has taken the same actions you have on those housing items. Moving forward, I will contact Jeremy Smith at the Truckee Meadows Regional Planning Agency regarding working with them on sharing with them what we're doing on climate change as per Mr. Young's request. I also will have Dan Segan of our staff make a presentation on the threshold update initiative either in January or shortly thereafter, depending on what else is on the agenda. And last but not least, I want to thank you for your, as you said, Mr. Chairman, your robust discussion, for the commitment you all make to the APC, and wish you all a happy holidays. And we are looking forward to next year because we do have a lot of things to tackle that we look forward to your input on. So just want to express our appreciation to you from staff. So thank you. And that's all I have in my report.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it. I'm going to go over to John Marshall, General Counsel status report.
Sorry, my sidebar was hidden. We've had a little spat of litigation. We actually, as an agency, filed 3 cases just over the last couple of days, enforcement cases on the illegal mooring of, pontoon boats off of Reagan Beach last summer. And so we have been trying to work cooperatively with our putative violators to come to some conclusion, but we've been able to. So we are hopefully taking this step to advance our both our compliance mission, but also to try to encourage settlement with those individuals. Essentially, they are mooring without not on a legal buoy. We have also some litigation initiated over, I think I may have touched on this last month, about a pier that was issued, pier permit that was issued and appealed to in Placer County, and a neighbor is contesting the issuance of the pier permit based on its proximity to their pier. And that's about it.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
See a couple of you at the party last night, or was that two nights ago?
Monday night. It was, yes. Thank you to TRPA for inviting us. It was a nice evening. Okay, now I will go over to APC members and ask if they have any reports. I'm just going to run down my list here. Garth is not with us. I'm going to ask Sam Booth.
Hey, thanks, Mr. Chair. I really don't have much to update you guys on from Douglas County. We have continued our efforts in updating our vacation home rental ordinance, and we've had some litigation over our approved vacation home rental ordinance. I believe our district attorney's office is presenting a revised ordinance to the Board of Commissioners for introduction next week and second reading in January, I believe. We had our, I think, our second meeting of our VHR advisory board last night. I suppose yesterday afternoon, it lasted into the night. New board that was established per the ordinance, and they've been very busy with reviewing applications and appeals from the ordinance. So that's a hot topic in Douglas County, but that's all I have to report for now.
Thank you, Sam. How about Judith Simon?
Yes, I do. On December 6th, which was Monday, the Incline Village Crystal Bay Citizens Advisory Board discussed the use of herbicides in Lake Tahoe. And we had been scheduled to hear from Dennis Sabaglo, but he was unable to be there. So we heard from Lars Anderson, UCD, and he's also a consultant for the Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association, and he outlined the proposal. We also heard from Madonna Dunbar. She's the executive director of the Tahoe Water Suppliers Association, who gave us a succinct history of this herbicide use in our lake and that we thought had been kind of put to bed long ago. While this was not an action item for us, we did direct our chair to inform our Washoe County Commissioner about the serious concerns we have about the project, and Madonna agreed to alert us to the timing of the hearings by both the Lahontan Water Board and by TRPA in January. So I don't know if we're going to be able to vet this at a future meeting before it goes to TRPA, but anyway, that's my report of the actions that we directed our chair to take toward our representative, our Washoe County representative.
Thank you, Judy. How about Susan Chandler?
Thank you very much. I guess the main thing that I'd like to do is to congratulate the City Council of South Lake Tahoe in unanimously passing the resolution to aspire towards citywide 100% renewable carbon-free electricity 24/7 by 2030. This is probably, I think we're probably the third city in the United States that has passed such an aggressive resolution, and I look forward to working with the city and TRPA to make this a reality. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Susan. That's a big one. How about Kevin Drake?
Just one quick update. I participated about a week ago in a focus group for the with the Tahoe Prosperity Center. Most of you probably heard they're working on a plan called Envision Tahoe that's essentially an economic prosperity plan for the Tahoe Basin and really creating a clear vision for greater economic diversity and sustainability in the Tahoe Basin moving forward, which doesn't clearly exist right now. So it's a really important effort. There's many focus groups going on. I'm guessing some of you on APC have been involved or will be involved. But keep an eye out. There's a survey coming out, I believe, before the end of the year. And they're trying to get a very broad sample of the population here. So I'll be forwarding on to the APC list when I get it. And I just encourage all of you to forward it on to as many people as you can so we get a really broad sample of the Tahoe population. That's all. You can go to tahoeprosperity.org. You can sign up for email updates, and then they'll probably send it directly to you as well.
Thanks, Kevin. Jason Drew.
No update. Just a final thought on today's discussion. I thought that was really productive. I know there are some people, some of us that have some concerns about elements of what we approve today, but I would encourage us to, and I know I will, and I'll be working with Chairman Ferry to connect with our governing board member for El Dorado County, since I'm the lead member for El Dorado County, to make sure that we communicate to her, you know, the things that were talked about today and some of the concerns that were raised as a part of our discussion. And I would encourage, you know, other APC members to do that. You know, our role is to provide a technical recommendation to the governing board, and then the governing board has to consider the technical merits, but also the political merits and other things that factor into governing board decisions. So I'd certainly encourage all of us to share with our representative governing board members, you know, the discussion we had today and the concerns about that particular topic.
Absolutely, Jason. Thank you. Eric Gavon.
Yes, we've been really busy at the fire district. As you know, we're working on a lot of the residual workload that's left over from the Caldor fire, getting information out with the Forest Service on backcountry safety. Backcountry safety week is next week, so we've been working on some information on that, keeping people safe back there with the trees that are unstable. In the burn scar and that kind of stuff. And also, of course, working on funding in the parasol group for the helicopter program and looking at getting a solely dedicated helicopter in the Tahoe Basin that's just dedicated here, won't be pulled out, and will be available for immediate response to put these fires out when they're small, which is a big thing for us. And how we've seen the fire behavior as of late, that's a really important thing to protect the basin. So working on that program, also working with the Forest Service on a public safety pier, and TRPA is helping us with that at the Zephyr Cove Marina. And looks like we'll be adding on to the pier, not creating a new one, but having a facility adjacent to the pier. So that's pretty exciting stuff. And I think that pretty much is what's been going on for us.
Thanks, Eric. Kevin Hill.
No update this month, but I do have just a quick comment. Just wanted to congratulate you, Brendan, and Jennifer for being reelected for another couple years. You guys do a great job, and I really want to commend you both for sending out that email, reaching out to APC members, and I look forward to speaking with you. And just kind of focusing on our individual strengths and things that we can bring to this board. So the last agenda item, I think, is exactly what you two want to see with the APC members, and just really impressed with the group. So looking forward to talking with you both.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Kevin. Appreciate it. How about Crystal Jacobson?
Yeah, thank you. I've just got two things. Well, one thing I brought up earlier is just that the transportation fee program update is going to our board on December 14th. and does apply countywide. And then also on the 14th, we're having a workshop on our short-term rental ordinance. We are undergoing an update. I think I mentioned that at our last meeting. But what I wanted to point out is that we're bringing forward some options for our board's consideration that would further kind of restrict or limit STRs in the North Tahoe area of Placer. And then also just point out that we consulted with Bay Area Economics to prepare a study, and that'll be included in the board packet. So if anybody that's interested, it's a study that looks at basically STR impact on housing availability and affordability, and then also looks at sort of the impact of STR supply on hotel and motel uses. So that, again, that'll be included as an attachment to the staff report for that December 14th board meeting and may be of interest to some of you. That's it for me.
Yeah, definitely. That's good information. Thanks, Crystal. Let's see, Mr. Lutton's not with us. Heather Ferris, I think, has left. I will go to Mr. Hitchcock.
Thank you, Chairman Ferry. Just two items. Measure T is in full effect. This is the last month. All VHRs and residential areas will be permanently closed, and we'll only have qualified vacation home rental permits and hosted rental permits in our residential zones. And we're one step closer to seeing Sugar Pine Village Affordable Housing Project being built. Related to California, the developer recently received a $3 million grant from HCD. So we're looking forward to that project being constructed in the future. That's it.
Great news. Thanks for sharing. Ellery, I'm not sure if Ms. Stoller is with us. I see her name on there, but I believe she's got other matters. Ellery, are you there? Okay, I'll move us along to Mr. Teixeira.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciated that Kevin mentioned the Envision Tahoe effort that TPC is coordinating. It's really, really important. Please fill out the survey, engage in any way that you can, and also look at their preliminary report on the sort of data they put together so far. Probably the most alarming thing is the tremendous exodus of young working people and families from the Tahoe community, really all around the region. It's very sobering. So, and it's a lot of good information that, you know, as APC members and as people involved elsewhere in our communities, is really important for us to understand what's happened in the last 7-8 years here in the Tahoe-Truckee region. So thanks, Kevin, for bringing that up. And I'm sure that the folks at TRPA have already identified this, but I know on page 23 in the operations work plan, it's Vance Honigman that's written there, although, of course, the new TRPA governing board member from San Francisco appointed by Governor Newsom is Vince Honigman. So happy holidays to all.
Thank you, Steve. Good catch. Mr. Young.
Hello, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I believe I already mentioned that Washoe County is just about to launch an effort to develop a community mobility plan. I think we're actually deciding on a consultant today, in fact. Happy to be doing that. It's exciting for us. It's something we haven't done. It's a major step in the implementation of our area plan. And I'll keep you all informed as we move forward in the development of that mobility plan for our small little community. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. How about Vice Chair Carr?
Thanks. I will mention for those who have potential projects, the ridiculous amount of money that is coming our way from all different sources, and what Nevada gets pales in comparison to what California gets just based on size and allocation formulas. But we were just informed that out of the bipartisan infrastructure law, for the first of 5 years, we're going to be receiving $71 million and change into our state revolving fund. That state revolving fund can not only address water and wastewater infrastructure, but it can also fund stormwater projects and non-point source solutions. And so they're having a listening session or a workshop tomorrow. If anyone's interested, I can hook you up with our state revolving fund folks. just to get project ideas. Our priority list is going to be opening the first part of next year so that we can start to get new ideas and new projects to use this new infusion of money and get it rolling for fall, when we anticipate we'll actually receive the award of $71 million. We are also working with the Treasurer's Office on Nevada's American Recovery Plan Act money, which is, you know, many more million. The Nevada Infrastructure Bank is being stood up. It was created several years ago, but now it's receiving its first infusion of $75 million in seed money for infrastructure in Nevada. So there's more money there. There was another pot of money that came to mind and now it slipped, but you get the gist. So even if you're from California, if you'd like to sit in on our SRF listening session, you can learn more about what the rules are, because the federal rules apply across, you know, they're basically the same regardless of what state you're in. So just putting it out there that if you want to talk about projects in Nevada, we need to start getting those compiled and on lists. We've got all kinds of things we're kind of keep track of. The other one was FEMA money. Because of the COVID disaster declaration and future monies related to the fire declarations, the state of Nevada has also got like $16 million to look at hazard mitigation. And we can do hazard mitigation planning projects through our Division of Emergency Management. That requires a match, but we just found out it can be matched with the state revolving fund money. So again, there's all sorts of pots of money. So if you have a need, tell somebody, because right now there's money. I'll stop there.
Good news. We like money. All right. That comes to me. I just say it was great to meet some of you for the first time Monday night and see some others at the TRPA party. Thanks again for that. Thank you again for your endorsement for me being chair. Apologize for my beklemptness earlier, but I'll try to do better. Thank you, Jennifer, for being vice chair. It's great to work with you. Really appreciated our robust discussion today. You know, kudos to everyone for digging in. I know everyone's busy. And I just want to say happy holidays to everyone and wish you all the best and a safe holiday season. I think it's a great time of the year, and hopefully everyone can see their families and not work so hard for a little while here. That concludes item 7. I need to move us into item 8, which is public interest comments here quickly. Members of the public participating in our meeting, now is your time to make any public comment you would like. Please note the APC is prohibited by law from taking immediate action on or discussing issues raised by the public not listed on the agenda. And Catherine, I will turn this over to you for any hands raised from the public.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a comment on this item.
Okay, thank you, Catherine. That brings us to item 9, which is adjournment. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Thank you. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
No one objects to that. And with that, we stand adjourned. It's 12:38. And everyone, please take care. Thanks a lot. Have a good day.